STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Oh, this isn't going to be about Jesus, is it?
All righty, everybody. Tom at the boards just gave me that look. That means I'm on. And glad to be with you. Greg Kokel here. The show will stand to reason. And we've got, one, two, 3 hours ahead of us of interacting with you on the phone, and taking your calls, questions, me offering you a piece of my mind here and there. That's what we do here on Stand to Reason, is I stand to reason for classical Christian values classical Christian belief or conviction would be a better way of putting it. I routinely tell people not to use, followers of Christ, that is, I tell them, don't use the word faith or belief when, if you can avoid it, when talking about your convictions. And there's my synonym substitute, because isn't it easy for people to simply add the phrase blind to your word faith? I should say the word faith, blind to your word faith, to create the phrase, in their mind at least, blind faith, or leap of faith. That's what happens when you say the word faith, or belief. That's just mere belief. That's just what religious people do when they have no good reason to know. They just believe. So I try to avoid that language. Since it's been corrupted, I want people to know I have convictions. That is, things that I am convinced of in virtue of good reasons. And anyway, that's what we're about here, giving a rationale for our convictions, because people need it much of the time, more so than they ever did before. I guess there was a time, even in my lifetime, when you could kind of just go out there with the simple gospel and that would be all that's necessary. In terms of their intellectual need, obviously the Holy Spirit is necessary every single time. You do, in fact, make a difference for the kingdom in the mind of a non-believer, and he or she is moved closer to the truth, or indeed steps forward and puts their trust in Jesus of Nazareth. Yeah, that's the Holy Spirit. But it used to be a shorter trip, didn't it? I mean, 30 or 40 years ago, you could get away with summing things up in a few minutes. And because we had shared vocabulary and shared concepts and largely a shared worldview, at least people understood what you were talking about. Well, those days are over. And this is one of the things that I talked about this past weekend in Columbus, Ohio, at a local church there that I had been at about 6 years ago, and I had a chance to come back and teach again there. It was always nice when that happens. But, yeah, I told them those days are over. You can't just bank on offering the simple gospel, because to people the gospel's not simple. There's a lot of competition out there now in the world of ideas. There's a lot of objections that have been raised by smart people, half of them with British accents, so it makes their points convincing even when they don't have good reasons. You know how that works. And people are not so ready to take seriously the Christian view of reality. And so so we make the case, right? That's why Stand to Reason is here. Our website, str.org, our radio show that many of you are podcasting now. And if you're not, the best way to get – I think the only way nowadays to get all 3 hours is to podcast, because I don't think any market carries the which one? Waco. Waco carries all 3 hours. Well, good. They were one of our if not our earliest station that, as we started our syndication bid. But for the most part, most of you listening are not going to get all 3 hours. The best way is just to simply podcast. Incidentally, if you'd like to call, you can, but you have to be calling during the live show, and that is from 4 until 7 Los Angeles time. We'll call that Los Angeles Pacific Daylight Time. 855-243-9975 is the number, and a number of you already in the queue, and I'll be talking to you shortly. Wanted to offer an observation about this weekend, though, when I was in Columbus. And let me back up, though, and set the stage. 40 years ago, actually almost to the date, 40 years and a month ago, I moved into a Christian community in Westwood Village, which is in Los Angeles area where UCLA is at. And there's an old fraternity house converted into a training school for followers of Christ, Jesus people, because this was the Jesus movement. And there were 60 or 70 students in residence, and there were others that lived off campus. That is, they didn't live in the house, what we called the Light and Power House. I know it sounds kind of corny now, the name, but it was a great place. 4 months after I became a Christian, I moved into that community. They had a women's wing, a men's wing, and they had corporate dining facilities and classroom area. So those of us who were part of that enterprise, I was there for 2.5 years, got some fabulous training theologically and in evangelism and a discipleship. It's where I met Craig Englert, who discipled me for 2 years at great risk to life and limb, and his wife Kathy, a tag team, keeping me in line. And I got training there. The people that were the teachers were almost all formerly Campus Crusade for Christ staffers. They were also, for the most part, trained at Dallas Theological Seminary, which means they had street smarts and substance. It's a great combination. And not only was the foundation laid for me, but a lot more than the foundation in those 2.5 years. But while I was there, there were a lot of other people that came through during that time. And in my second year at the Light and Power House, two guys from Ohio, Dennis McCallum and Gary DeLashmet, young Jesus freaks like me, long hair, beards, funky, loving the Lord, wanting to sink their roots deeper, were classmates of mine during that time. After they finished, they went back to Ohio, settled in Columbus, which might have been where they were from, I don't know, but eventually founded a church that now is one of the most vibrant churches in the entire region. It's called Xenos Christian Fellowship, X-E-N-O-S. I had a chance to spend some time with Dennis, just reconnecting a little bit. Every 6 or 7 years, it seems, or maybe every 10 years, we were able to touch base, and I didn't see Gary, but it was great to sit with them, just meet him at their inner city facility. They have a facility right in the middle of town. Actually, it's a little bit of a rougher neighborhood, and they got an old building that had been standing vacant for a decade. They bought it for a song and transformed it into, it's like a huge Starbucks that has meeting rooms that will hold, well, each one, there's two there, that will hold about 800 people. And they can also rent it out for banquets and the like. But it's a fabulous facility. And they have, I think, about 8 different church services that meet at different times during the week. So it's not just a Sunday service. If you're on a student there at Ohio State, you know, Sunday's not always the best time. Other things are going on, so they meet during the week in the evenings and different times. And it's great the way they work it out. Basically what happens is there's about 8 different sub-churches that meet at that facility. And these sub-churches are comprised of about 20 home groups. So the 20 home groups are under a staff pastor who then meet at one of these assigned times together as a smaller church, which is, in a sense, part of the larger structure, so you don't have to waste money recapitalizing and all of that. And you still are part of a larger community, but you're in there and you're actually worshiping and getting taught from a pastor that is in a satellite of that, 800 people in a group, and then each of those broken down into roughly 20 smaller groups. So you're really close to a core group of people, though you're part of that larger satellite church that meets at different times in this facility. And then something like that happens with the larger facility that's on the edge of the metropolitan area. And as we were talking, Dennis made the point that most churches, as they're doing just their analysis, most churches get their members, 90% plus of their members have come from other churches, which means that on balance, churches are not populating their audiences by winning new people to Christ and building their church that way. It's because there's a lot of mobility. People are moving around from church to church. It's not that there's so much church member stealing, because people can go where they want. But it does underscore a liability in local churches I want to be careful how I say this. I almost said that evangelism isn't happening. Well, it doesn't mean it isn't happening. I suspect in the church evangelism is happening. That is, at the services, the message is mentioned. But I have said this before. If your church is a seeker-centered church, that is where evangelism is primarily done, and that's your focus, is the people who are non-Christians that come in, and you have an altar call or something like that every Sunday, and there's always this basic gospel message, then your church isn't functioning as a church. It's an evangelistic organization. And there's nothing wrong with people coming to Christ at your church, but the idea is not that people come into the church to become Christians, but rather that Christians go out into the marketplace and make a difference there to influence people. And there are most of the people in the inner city version on 4th Street there in Columbus of Xenos Christian Fellowship are not the kind of people that are going to go to a standard church. Now, I don't know how their music and worship is. I didn't stay for a service. It's probably more young, contemporary, whatever, but I know that their message is solid. I know these guys from the beginning. And I also know that 80% of the people that come to the church have become Christians from within that community. And that's unbelievable. I don't mean that they came to church and became a Christian. I mean, one way or another, through the community, they generate their own body. they brought these people to the Lord, and that strikes me as the way it ought to be. But I'll tell you, one of the things that makes a big difference is there, and as far as I could tell, it isn't like they have this big plan to do it just so. All these, you know, this whole idea of satellites and cell groups, actually they call those larger satellite churches spheres. Dennis said that just happened more or less by accident. What wasn't by accident was their deep commitment to one-on-one discipleship. The leaders discipling a group of people, and after a year or two of close, personal, dedicated, intentional discipleship, these members of this group went out and started their own groups. And the leadership of the church started with another group. So you have a multiplication there. Nicely chronicled, by the way, in Master Plan of Evangelism by Robert Coleman, a book I read when I was a brand new Christian, and you still don't need anything more clever than that. Following Jesus' method, he took 12 men and he worked with them for 2 or 3 years and sent them out. And they went and did something like the same, and through this process of personal interaction and training up in the way they should go, in a very basic foundational 4-point growth program, which is the standard program for the growth of any Christian, of the word, prayer, worship, and fellowship, I think, are the 4 points. It's just almost so basic. It's what we learned 40 years ago in the Jesus movement. They're still doing the same thing. They're just following the instructions. And it's incredible how their numbers have increased. And I don't want to make the numbers the issue. What matters is I think the more impressive thing is not the size of their overall group. Because remember, these are a number of spheres that each is a smaller church, a de facto church within their larger group. Excuse me, but rather the 80% number, that there is life here. They have found a way to engage, be authentic, be real, communicate, not through the pastors doing all the work. Obviously, you can't get numbers like that just with pastors evangelizing. Too much work to do. This is individuals spreading out in the community, as it were, and making a difference. So anyway, it was good to see Dennis and to see how God was working, and he was kind of shrugging his shoulders at different points, like it isn't like we've got this magnificent program that magically turns out productive churches. Basically, they're just doing the same old, building the foundation. I checked on the internet as people are weighing in with their point of view, and a number of them said this church has church members that know what they're about. That is, the rank and file has a higher level of understanding of the foundations, the basics of Christianity, and no doubt it's because of the one-on-one attention that's being given. So there's two things that impress me here that I just want to leave before we go to the break, leave behind for you. It's nice seeing an old friend who had not only persevered after 40 years, a lot of members of the Jesus Movement didn't, but it's nice to see friends still staying faithful to the original vision and continuing on and are moving towards a strong finish. We can start well, many do, but far fewer end well as well. And part of my goal here now, pushing 64 in 2 months, is that right? March, April, May, June, 3 months, just a little bit shy of 3 months, is I want to end well. I want to finish well. I don't want to sputter and falter here as I'm, you know, going to kind of work on my final laps. And it could be another 30 years, who knows? But the thing is, I just want to keep on keeping on and be faithful in it and to end well. And these men are on the track for that. And that encourages me, and I hope it encourages you. End well, and for the long haul. Okay. And secondly, just the importance of the basics, investing yourselves in the individual lives of other people. There are lots of ways of doing that, and it doesn't have to be fancy. You don't have to have a big program. I saw people in that building there on 4th Street in the city, the Xenos Fellowship building, that in one whole section, long, big section, just looked like a big Starbucks. They had their coffee guys there and everything, and tables all around and couches, and there were a lot of people there, and interacting and talking about Christ. There was somebody with spiritual leadership book, J. Oswald Sanders, the same book I read 40 years ago when I was at the Light and Powerhouse. I still have my copy. And basic stuff. And Coleman's Master Plan of Evangelism, basic stuff. Just laying down the foundation in a basic way. That's what it is. And 2 weeks ago when I talked about contending earnestly for the faith, I spent most of the time in Timothy, 2 Timothy, Paul's last book, which is about guarding the gospel and passing the baton. The things that you've heard from me, Paul writes to Timothy in the presence of many witnesses, these entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. There's the baton being handed from Paul to Timothy, the faithful men who will teach others. 4 generations and on down the line for 2,000 years, that baton has been passed. So who are you passing the baton to? In one way or another, if you have children, they should be first in line, but not the only ones in line. Anyway, just a thought. Okay. I'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Stand to Reason, and I'm Greg Kokel.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STRTV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STRTV, Christianity worth thinking about.
All right, go the distance, friends. That's the lesson here. Let's see what you have to say in New Jersey. Lucas, you're first on board. Lucas?
Oh, hello.
Hello.
That's interesting. This is my first time actually calling. I wrote everything that I want to say just to make sure I don't forget.
Well, good for you. I do the same thing, really. Yeah. Like if I'm a little nervous about a phone call, whether it's a personal call to somebody, and I used to do this even when I'd call girls when I was a teenager, you know. And now when I'm on an interview with somebody that I've been on lots of times before or something and I'm professional, I still write some things down so I can get in and out of the segments easily. And so I'm impressed. That's a good move. There's wisdom in what you just did.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that so I'm just saying that in case you feel that I'm reading, because I'm just going to be reading whatever.
Oh, okay. If it sounds like you're reading, it's because you are reading, right?
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
All right. As long as the reading isn't too long. Sometimes reading can get a little laborious. I always use my notes as kind of a crib sheet so I could say what I wanted to say, but it didn't sound like I was reading. You know, when girls think you're reading to them, you know, it doesn't impress them. Okay.
So I was listening to your podcast from last week, and One of the subjects that came out was eternal punishment, and so you were talking about how eternal punishment might make sense. Why is it eternal, right? And I just had a thought on that, and I wanted to see what your comments were.
Okay.
And I also have something else after, so I'll try to make this quick. So what I thought was that God's moral standard is perfection. God is perfect.
Right. Morally perfect, right.
So, since his standard is perfection, any bad thing that we do or sin is infinitely away from that perfection. And thus, because it is infinitely away, repaying for that it's like an infinite payment. That's the way I saw it.
Okay. So you just want me to respond to that before you get to the next issue?
I think it
sounds to me like you have possibly an equivocation where the terms are used differently in each case. I don't know what it means to be infinitely away from God's perfection. If God is morally perfect, I wouldn't call that an infinite characteristic.
Okay.
It is just moral perfection. There's no infinity involved in the perfection.
So
to be morally imperfect wouldn't put you infinitely away. So maybe it's a category error. I don't know if those are the right words to use to describe God. There is something going there that I think is relevant. God's standard is perfect, and he is the one that properly deserves the obedience of each of his subjects, because God is the is the sovereign, the appropriate sovereign of the universe. And when we rebel against him, since he is the highest authority, perfectly good, then that represents one of the most egregious kinds of violations of law. I'm stuttering here a little bit because I'm trying to think of the best way to say it. The illustration I usually give is I ask a parent, if your child hit another child, would that be bad? Yes. So they get a punishment? Yes. What if they hit you? That is, the manner of striking you was exactly the same manner of physically striking the other child. Would it be exactly the same? And the answer is, of course not. Because even though the physical action is the same, you are their dad, you know, and so therefore, because of your higher stature, the moral offense is more egregious. And so something like that is in view here. Since God is not only morally perfect, but he is also the appropriate sovereign, then to offend the sovereign is a maximally egregious and then deserves the maximal punishment, which is banishment forever. And since we are made to be with God, that's how we are designed by God to function most perfectly in friendship with him. When we are isolated or from him, banned from his presence, then we are ruined for our purpose. And consequently, that is a terrible state of affairs for us. So that's kind of the way I would compare God's perfection with our fallenness as it touches on the hell issue. But that wasn't the main reason you called, though, right? You had something else?
No. Yeah. So the second thing is that I want to ask you a quick question first. What is your definition of omnipotence for God?
Unlimited power. That is, anything that power can accomplish, God can accomplish it because he has no lack of power. I don't think I'd want to say that every ounce of power is God's power, because I certainly have some power, and it's not his, it's mine. But there is nothing that I can do with my power that God can't do equally. So therefore, remember, omnipotent is all power, that he's all powerful. Yeah. He can do anything that power is capable of doing. So when you talk about making a square circle, that's not a function of power. That's the failure to do so is not a failure of power. It's a contradictory notion. So something along that line, that's the way I kind of characterize it. Others might put it a little bit more elegantly than I did, but
all right.
Okay.
Yeah,
so you're setting me up here with a Columbo question, huh? Okay, where are we going with this?
Yeah, I did.
All right.
The reason I ask is and you said something different, so this question might not be a very good.
That's why I was very careful how I answered.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I wasn't trying to get you to a contradiction or anything. Don't worry.
Right.
I've been listening to. Every once in a while, I listen to some apologists or people and debates or whatever. Mm-hmm. And one definition of omnipotence that I've seen some apologists say is that it is being able to do everything that is possible for the nature of the thing in question.
Okay. Like all right.
But since you did not use that definition, then this question might be real.
When you say possible, then I think those are fair qualifiers. I'd want to hear that fleshed out a little bit more. But what I'd want to limit it to, I'd want to say you can do everything that power can do. And so, because it is omnipotence that relates to power, and then probably this is why they qualified it the way they did, but my qualification just makes it easier for me to sidestep some challenges that aren't appropriate to this this concern.
That's true. Okay. So you did sidestep a challenge that I heard from this, because the reason I was asking is because I heard a challenge to this view, and I did not hear a response.
Okay.
Because the subject went into a tangent or something, and then they forgot to talk about it.
Yeah.
But so the challenge was that then you could apply this to, say, a wooden table in my kitchen. It is not within its nature to, like, go around moving. Thus, you could say it is omnipotent because it can only do the things that are in its nature. But
I missed the part about the wooden table in the kitchen. Was there a verb there? What did I miss? Say it again.
So I heard an apologist say that the omnipotence was being able to do everything.
No, I heard that part. I heard that part.
And then the atheist that was debating that person said, well, then you could apply this to, for example, a wooden table. And you would say, well, this table is not within its nature to move around or do things. Thereby, it's only doing what's within its nature. Thus, it's omnipotent. And that doesn't make sense.
So his argument, so the atheist was saying that the way that the person had defined omnipotence was not really very helpful because a table would be omnipotent by that definition.
Correct.
Okay.
And I know there are some definitions of what the nature of the table is.
So then you get fussing about little words. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's not. Mm-hmm.
But I guess the main idea of that challenge was, I don't know, I thought it was accurate and I didn't hear a response to it. With your definition, you sidestep that.
I don't think there's anything wrong with my definition. It's omnipotent, and so it just is simple for me. But notice that sometimes we are trying to capture in words a perfection about God in a way that captures the perfection, but then does not leave us open to kind of foolish challenges that people make. Yep. Like, can God lift a rock, make a rock so big he can't lift it?
Yeah.
Now, to me, this is an incoherence that's involved here, because it's like, it's pitting one aspect of God against itself. So this is like asking, if God arm wrestled against himself, who would win? Well, he would win and he would lose. That's why this is not a helpful kind of challenge, and I don't think it's a serious challenge. There's nothing incoherent about it. No, God cannot make a rock so big he can't lift it. But that is not a limitation to his omnipotence. So, in my view, I think that these are kind of silly word game type rejoinders. So,
yes.
Yeah. And I want to avoid those because they don't take us anywhere valuable.
Yeah. The reason I ask is because, just to start building a good definition of omnipotence, because if you don't have a good definition of it, it seems like there's a lot of dumb challenges that could.
Yeah, out. And you may want to take a look at some systematic theology to see how they've characterized it. You know, this people have been working on this for a long time, or maybe go to Bill Craig's website and see if he's got a really precise philosophic definition or something. I'm not. You know, that these are possibilities. It isn't like we don't have good. Characterizations at our fingertips if we look around a little bit. I just have opted for this other way of characterizing it because I think it's a fairly quick way to get to a pretty accurate characterization without getting into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Lucas?
Yes.
Okay, sounds like you're your dessert there, so I'm going to let you go. Appreciate the call. And let's see where we're at here. Why don't we go break early, and then we'll come back to Brent and Torrance, all right? You're listening to Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians, just like you, will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that'll help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that'll help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a four-part template that'll help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the Gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the Gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the Gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
Greg Kokel here with you every week for freewheeling open discussion on contemporary ethical issues, defense of classical Christianity, and a defense of classical Christian values. Number 855-243-9975 during the live show. Now it'll be Tuesdays from 4 to 7 Los Angeles time. Let's talk in Torrance right down the road from me with Brent. Hello, Brent.
Hey, Greg. Hey. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I follow you on Facebook. I'm a long-time listener. I think you recently celebrated a 20th or 25th anniversary.
We did. It's the 20th, but you know, next month, 6 weeks, and we'll be 5 weeks, and we'll be 21. It's just like that last year just blew by so fast. Oh, my goodness. The days drag on and the years fly by.
Yeah, isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
I've called, this is probably my third or fourth call over that duration, and you guys have always been there for me. In fact, I'm a graduate student at CSUDH, and as an undergraduate over a decade ago now, or about a decade ago now, I was a member of the Association of Political Science Students, mm-hmm. and we invited you, or at least I did. I was the only Christian and conservative in the club or the student org. And
where was this at?
I'm sorry?
Where was this at?
At CSUDH, Dominguez Hills, Cal State University.
Oh, yeah, okay. That was a while back, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, over a decade ago, probably about 11 or 12 years ago.
Yeah.
You did a Chalk Talk.
Yes.
And then one of your colleagues, I believe his name was Steve, actually.
Steve Wagner.
Participated in a debate on abortion that I organized on behalf of that student org as well. So.
Well, good. It's nice to reconnect with you.
Yes, likewise. So recently on Facebook, I had an encounter with a friend of mine who was just making a general observation about the nature of change. Mm-hmm. And I replied with the following. Everything changes, everything but God.
Mm-hmm.
He replied with a reference to Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 6 through 11, asking me the following question.
Hold on just a minute. Deuteronomy 13, 6 through 11. Okay. You know, I'm getting a little crackling on the line. I don't know if that's something at your end you could do something about, but...
You're no longer on speaker. Yeah, I noticed that as well.
I thought
it might have been simply because I was on hold, so I'll try to make this quick.
Yeah, it's okay. Go ahead.
The question was as follows. Would I kill a son, or daughter presumably, who tries to persuade me that Hinduism, or any other religion for that matter, is, other than Christianity, of course, mm-hmm. is the correct path? I answered no, and that the verse doesn't apply to me. And then I asked him to give me some time and that I would try to come up with a more thoughtful, substantive response.
Uh-huh.
And after some pointed prayer, some critical thought, some cursory research, I responded with a clear, concise, 6-point response. It's very brief, and I'd like to run it by you for your evaluative criticism.
Good for you.
One, it's God's prerogative what he wills. Two, with Israel, God is setting aside a chosen people in preparation for the God-man, i.e. Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Three, Deuteronomy is a formal treaty, if you will, between God and his chosen people, the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
Four, the events depicted in the OT, Old Testament, as well as some of the events portrayed in the New Testament, occur prior to the advent of the God-man and prior to his crucifixion, death, and resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
5, the God-man is the promised seed of faith to God's chosen people. And 6, in him, we are become his chosen people.
Hmm, okay.
And I was trying to, you know, demonstrate that something along the lines of what it says about how it characterizes Christ in Hebrews 13:8. Mm-hmm. Jesus mm-hmm. never changes, so forth. Mm-hmm. He's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Mm, that's right. So, you still there?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought maybe I lost you for a second. Okay, so you want me to respond to that related to God never changing, Jesus never changing, but there's these particulars that you mentioned that have a influence or have a bearing on that particular passage from Deuteronomy.
Yeah, I'm not really good with the Old Testament, and I was doing my best trying to reply since that was the chapter and verse
right.
of that book that he brought up.
Okay, well, you threw six things against the wall here, and I'd say 1.5 stuck. Okay, so that's good. I think your answer is in here, but I want to make some clarification. Okay,
sure, thank you.
And I'd want to be careful with number one. That is something to the sense that what God wants from us is his prerogative. Is that what you said? How did you?
Yes, and I realized I was afraid that might be problematic.
It could be problematic, but because what we don't want to say is that God's laws are just arbitrary expressions of his power.
Of course.
Yeah, God is just not making it up today, and he can make up something else tomorrow. And since he's in charge, whatever he says goes, even if he says today the opposite of what he said yesterday.
Yeah, that was my concern.
Okay, good. I'm glad you see the problem. So I'm going to just strike that one. Now, it's saying that Israel were the chosen people, that certainly is true if you understand chosen properly. You mention in number 6 that we are the chosen people now in him. It seems like you're suggesting that the concept of chosen is essentially the same in both cases. The Jews used to be chosen, but now we're chosen.
Well, I meant to say that in both cases, we were chosen by grace through faith.
Yeah, well, that would be true, but I think that overlooks or maybe clouds a very important issue.
Okay.
So let me make the distinction here. In number 2, you said Israel was the chosen people. Yes, they were chosen for a purpose. They
mm-hmm.
were God's instrument, and you do mention this at some point. They were God's instrument to accomplish a plan of rescue for the world that culminated in God become a man as a member of the Jewish race to then die on a cross for man's crimes against God. So Israel was chosen for a purpose to accomplish an end. They were not chosen to be saved. They were chosen to be used to produce salvation or to accomplish the plan of salvation, which is what happened by God's grace in spite of the Jews themselves. Now, many of those Jews actually took advantage and were faithful, took advantage of the mercy offered through that plan. Many, though, were wayward. So nothing about Israel's chosenness secures salvation for them. That just secures a salvation plan for the world, and whether they individually participate in it or not is another question. In number 6, we, though, are the chosen by definition because those who are in Christ, putting their trust in him, are the ones that are benefiting from that plan of salvation because we put our confidence in him, and so we are chosen regarding salvation. So the chosenness is very different in number 2 and number 6. The key, I think, point here, because remember what you want to argue is that God is the same yesterday, today, and today, and forever. Jesus is the same yesterday and today, forever, because he is God. But
yeah.
Because God doesn't change does not mean that the way he deals with mankind doesn't change. It does.
Yeah.
And so you had God dealing with Adam and Eve in one way, and then God dealing with the Jews through Abraham with a new plan, and then there was a unique relationship he had with the nation of Israel as part of the execution of that plan, and there is a unique kind of plan that he has in the new covenant that's expressed through Jesus and what he did on the cross. So God, yes, he changes lots of different things. He can make these plans and play these things out so that certain things apply in sometimes and other things don't apply later. And I think the third point you made was the most appropriate to the question. The third point being, this is a treaty God made with the Jews. That's it. The way I would get to this tactically with an atheist like that who's raising the objection, and I say, where is this at? Well, it's in Deuteronomy. Right. What is Deuteronomy? Well, Deuteronomy, now he probably isn't going to know. It's a book in the Bible. Wait, what book? What was the point of that book? Deuteronomy means second. Deuteronomos means second law. Deuteronomy is the second time the law is given. It's first given in Leviticus when Moses is at Mount Sinai. There's 40 years of wandering. The first generation dies away. We've got a new generation that's now going to take the land under Joshua. And before Moses dies, he gives that same law again a second time in Deuteronomy to the new generation that is now meant to take the land and live according to this law. The important thing is this is Mosaic covenant. It is an agreement that God made with Israel. It is not an agreement God made with anyone else.
Good. So my initial response was accurate in that it doesn't apply to us. It doesn't apply to me.
Yes, it doesn't. That's correct. And it's not because, yes, it is correct with qualification.
Yeah.
And here's
the
way I'm going to want to put it, and I know there are going to be friends of mine that are sharp people that are going to disagree, but here's the way I want to put it. Nothing that is in the Mosaic law applies to me as a Gentile in virtue of it being in the Mosaic law.
Right.
No command is incumbent upon me in virtue of being part of the law. Now, here's the best way to characterize this. Let's see. You're in Torrance. You and I both live in California.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is nothing in California law that applies to somebody living in Ohio.
Yeah.
Ohio has its own statutes. Now, there is a statute against murder in California. Now, does that mean since I'm not in California, it's okay for me to murder in Ohio?
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not under the California statute, but I am under the Ohio statute, okay? And part of the reason is because there are a lot of rules that are in statutes that turn out to be the kind of rules that should apply in any situation, in any state, and you're going to find them repeated. But then there's also going to be laws and rules that are unique to that state's situation.
Right.
The Mosaic Covenant, you think of it like a state law.
Mm-hmm.
It was given to the people in that state for that period of time. We are in a different state now. We have a different covenant that applies to us, and that's the new covenant, and different moral obligations. We are not obliged by everything in the Mosaic Law. That was a set of civil obligations, and that were applicable to those people under that time. It was made between God and Moses and the Jews. You know, God took them out of the land. He rescued them. They owed him. And now they were going to have to keep the terms of that covenant. If they did, he would protect them. If they didn't, he would forsake them. And this is in Deuteronomy 28 through 30. So they had their contract. That contract is no longer in force. It has been replaced for everyone, including Jews, by the new contract. And the new contract is a new enterprise. Gentiles were never under the old contract. And the Jews who were under it are now under the new contract with the Gentiles who put their faith in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean we can go around murdering people because we're not under the Mosaic law? No. The obligation not to murder is a universal and should be in any law.
Or a flip side of that, as he was challenging me, does that mean it would be a sin if I didn't murder somebody who was trying to convert me to another, you know?
Yeah, the answer is no. It would not. It would not be a sin if you didn't, because this particular thing in Deuteronomy does not apply to you.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's why I asked the question. Where is this Deuteronomy? What is Deuteronomy? Who wrote it? Moses. What role does it play? It's part of the civil code, the legal code for Jews. Am I a Jew? No. Am I under the theocracy? No. Then the legal code for Jews does not apply to you.
Yeah. So if we were actually in conversation, that would have been I could have done that as well. It was a Facebook convo, but the quickest reply would have just to turn it right back on him and with the Columbo tactic and ask him a question.
Yeah, this is Columbo number three. Since we know where we're going with it, we're going to make a point with the question. Mm-hmm. And we're going to help him to see that part of his problem is his ignorance of the Old Testament. He can find a verse to throw at us because he read it on the Internet. He doesn't have his understanding, though, why that wouldn't properly apply to us. He says, well, you're just picking and choosing. No, I'm not. I have a rationale why this doesn't apply in the same way and why others might. And the things that do apply as universal moral obligations from the Mosaic Law are going to be repeated in the New Testament to Gentiles. These things are not repeated because we are not under that theocracy. It's just exactly like being in a separate state.
Yeah, the one that I did notice that is repeated is when Jesus says, you're to love your God with your whole heart, your whole mind, and your whole soul.
Yeah,
that's Deuteronomy, right?
Right. He takes that as a summary statement, and then your neighbor as yourself. He says the whole law, the spirit of the law, is really captured in those two verses. So he uses that as a summary statement, but part of it was in response to the Jews, and this is a little background information. The Jews realized that when you got all these laws, it's hard to keep them all. And so what they So what they tried to do is, well let's just major in the majors. Let's keep the most important one. And there were debates between them about which law was the greatest commandment. And so they asked Jesus, which one's the greatest commandment? Now, the motivation to find the greatest commandment is you focus on keeping that really well and you don't worry so much about the other ones. Well, the other ones matter, but let's just major in the majors. So what does Jesus say? Okay, here, I'll give you the two great commandments. You know, you don't have to worry about the rest of them if you can fulfill these. Love your God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And then if you remember the lawyer who raised this, he said, and it said, seeking to justify himself, he said, well, who is my neighbor? And then you get the parable of the Good Samaritan. Even your enemy is your neighbor that you should be loving. But notice he said, seeking to justify himself.
Right.
Okay.
He wasn't interested in really knowing the truth or discovering the truth.
Well, I think he's interested in finding a way out where he can work his own salvation out by himself.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I'll keep those laws. No, I'm just going to tell you, I've been a Christian for 40 years. I have not had a split second of my life as a follower of Christ when I loved the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, strength, and mind. Not a split second. And I think there probably been a moment or two in 40 years that maybe I have loved my neighbor as myself. But for most of the time, no. So what this means is I cannot justify myself, Greg Kokel here speaking autobiographically, based on the demands of those simple commandments, those summary commandments. I can't do that. I'm sunk by those commandments. I'm deep sixed. I'm out of luck. And I think this was Jesus' point. You want to go, you want to justify yourself? Fine. Here, try this one on for size. We'll just limit it to two. Oops. You're done for. So what Jesus is doing in that particular case is he is emphasizing the complete impossibility of self-justification. Let me offer you a little sideline on this one, too, because I just put this together just a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
You know, people want to talk about Jesus' ministry and social justice and loving your neighbor and everything else. Well, Jesus did teach to love your neighbor as yourself. There's no question. There it is. We're talking about it right now. But it is important to see the context in which he taught that. People want to make it sound like Jesus' main role was social justice. Go out and take care of the poor. Jesus never said go out and take care of the poor in terms of the people who are poverty-stricken. He never said that, ever. Look at every major discourse. Look at every gospel. You're not going to find that. You know, well, love one another, love your brother. He said that. Well, he did say, he did make reference to the poor, but he was always making a different point. When he talked of the poor woman with the widow's mite, he was talking about her generosity. It wasn't about poverty or poor people. It was about this woman's generosity. When he tells the rich man who says he's kept all the law to give everything he owns to the poor and come follow Jesus, he's not making a statement about the poor. He's making a statement about the rich man's lack of keeping the law, where his real idol was. In every single case where the poor is mentioned, except for in the case of poor in spirit, and this is talking about spiritual poverty, and I think when Jesus quotes Isaiah, "I've gospel preached to the poor," I think it's the same thing. It's the spiritually poor, those who realize their spiritual poverty and are beating their breast and saying, "Have God have mercy on me, a sinner." And Jesus meets them at that point, and the gospel rescues them. But as for the financially poverty stricken, I'm interested to find a verse where Jesus is speaking explicitly about helping the financially poverty-stricken. And for those who want to point at this love your neighbor, notice that even when Jesus is talking about loving your neighbor, he is not advancing it as a separate ethic. The way we ought to live our lives is love our neighbor. He's saying that this sums up the obligation of the Old Testament law, and it is meant to be a further burden on anyone that is seeking to justify himself, which is the case for the person who asked the question. And if you're seeking to justify yourself, then you have to treat your neighbor this way, and you're not going to be able to treat your neighbor this way, not consistently. Therefore, you're going to fail. You can't justify yourself. That was Jesus' point. I don't want to undermine the force of the moral obligation to love our neighbor, but I just want to make the point that that wasn't the main point that Jesus had in mind. He wasn't saying, gee, here we go, friends. I've got a new way to live. I've got a new way to... Here it is. I'm here to tell you to love one another and to take care of the poor.
Now, right.
That's a complete mischaracterization of Jesus. And do you receive our material? Okay, last word here then at the top of the hour. In a week or two, you're going to get a mentoring letter from me, and I go into detail on this. So keep an eye open for that, and then the rest of you as well. Thanks for the call, Brent from Torrance, and we'll be back here in about 2 minutes with another full hour and another after that of Stand to Reason. Please stay with us. I'm Greg Kokel. Welcome back, my friends. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. And I got to tell you a story about a hummingbird. This is our second hour of the regular show. I'm not sure where you're coming in at. Whole show available, str.org, for our podcast, of course, for free. Go to iTunes. It's kind of like a combination of YouTube and iTunes. And so we have a hummingbird nest right outside our sliding door. And my wife has a number of hanging plants there on our patio. And one is a wandering Jew, which is a, I think it is. It's a viney kind of plant hanging down, and it's got the creepers kind of hanging and swaying. And the bottom of it is maybe 4 or 3 feet off the ground. And we noticed that a hummingbird built a nest in the vine. Now, it's just hard to describe because I know what you're probably thinking. You're thinking of kind of a thatch of vines woven together that represent a kind of platform, and then a bird can create a nest sitting on the platform of the loosely interwoven vines, but it's nothing like that. It is a vine of the plant that's hanging down and curling at different spots, and in a curve of the vine, this hummingbird made a nest. Now, it's amazing to me because I didn't watch it making the nest. Although it's in full view, we now have the sliding door kind of blocked off. We have big curtains across it, so when we don't want to disturb the female too often, or maybe it's the male that sits on the nest, I don't know, the bird. And so we part the curtain just a little bit at the right spot, and we can peek out and see this nest that's about 2 feet away. It's a perfect viewing position. It's perfect. But I can't for the life of me figure out how this hummingbird did this, because I couldn't do that. I couldn't build a little structure in that piece of vine the way the bird did. And it's a perfect nest. It's all woven together with little bitty fine things glued together by, I don't know, hummingbird spit or something, with a nice little depression in it about, I don't know, what size is it? It's about the size of a size of a golf ball cut in half with a small depression carved out of it's magnificent. And it's when I look at things like this, never mind the hummingbird itself, I'm just thinking of the hummingbird nest, which is much less complex than the bird and its ability to fly in three different directions, forward, backward, and nowhere, I guess. It just hovers the way it does uniquely. But this nest is so magnificent. How is it that these critters know how to do that? They are masterpieces of engineering. Like I said, I would be hard-pressed to make anything like it. It certainly would not be as elegant-looking. Maybe I could tie things together in such a way as that something might rest on whatever it is that I made without falling through and dying. But, I mean, me with my massive intelligence, as a human being, that is, here's a bird with a pea brain. Actually, its brain isn't as big as a pea. Its head is a pea. This is a hummingbird. They're small. And for this critter to make this nest so that its babies are now housed safely in there, as long as we keep the cat away, it just blows my mind. And it's one of the many times when I say, tell me there's no God. Of course, I know the evolutionary story. The problem is the story isn't going to work here. You cannot just wave a wand, call it evolution, and then tell a story that is going to be adequate, I think, to explain every hummingbird's capability of making exactly the same kind of nest. Because I don't for a moment believe that there were these itty-bitty changes in the molecular structure of the DNA of a hummingbird that began to give it the impulse to make a nest a little bit at a time. And after they put a couple of things on, then little bitty birdies can last a little bit longer than the other little birdies who didn't have that parent that had that small shift. And so then there was another shift, and pretty soon, after a while, you had this really cool-looking nest. No, you pretty much have to have the whole thing all at once. It's all or nothing. And these are instinctual patterns. These are complex behaviors that are not learned. They're inbred. I'm not saying they don't learn anything. I'm just saying these things aren't learned. So this is just it's like a wild kingdom out our back door, watching these little hummingbirds grow. They're itty bitty things. You think a hummingbird is small? You got to see a hummingbird chick. Is that what they're called? Hummingbird. What would you call it? I guess a chick. They're itty. And that mommy comes and feeds them, flies off. They're getting bigger too. Pretty soon they'll fly the coop, so to speak, and then we will be able to use our sliding glass door again. I think I'm going to have my wife clip off that little vine. Maybe I'll take a picture of it. I should do that. Melinda, remind me. Send me an email, okay, please, to take a photo of that. When the hummingbird is gone, she's off feeding or something. I look out, she's not there. I'll open the door. I'll take a picture. I'll put it on my Facebook. Okay, and those of you can go by my Facebook and take a look. And you see what I'm talking about? It's amazing. Let's see. I wanted to respond to something that came up last weekend. A woman who was jousting with an atheist about the authority of the Bible. And when I do events, lots of times I get good people that come up to me and say, I'm just like who call me, say I'm struggling with this person. I don't know how to deal with this, and it had to do with the reliability of the New Testament or the Bible, the authority of the Bible. The Bible has errors and things like that. And she said, I don't know how to deal with these charges that there are contradictions in the Bible. Now, apparently, I don't know exactly the nature of the conversation, whether they're talking about the Bible per se at that time or just about God, but it seems to me if you're dealing with an atheist, the first order of business is God, not the Bible. And let's just forget about the Bible for a while. Let's just talk about God. Because if you don't believe in God, then you're not going to believe that God inspired the Bible. And my recommendation to her is when the atheist keeps bringing up the Bible, you tell him, well, I'm not talking about the Bible right now. I mean, if you want to talk about the Bible, you're welcome to talk about the Bible, but then he's going to bring up problems in the Bible that you may not be able to answer for. I'll give you a little insight on that for a minute, but my first step, I told her, is just try to stay away from the Bible for the time being. First things first, okay? Tell him the Bible's not your point. God is your point, and that's what you want to talk about. Secondly, whenever I do talk about the Bible, as part of my case for Christianity, I limit my conversations to the Gospels principally, and I don't deal with them as inspired texts. So if somebody says, well, there are contradictions in the Gospels, say the resurrection account, and I would say, well, that doesn't matter to me right now because I am not talking about the Bible as a divinely inspired text. Do I believe it is? Yes, I do. It's a separate discussion, though. The nature of inspiration and the degree to which the Bible is inspired, as far as I'm concerned, is an in-house discussion. It is a discussion that Christians have among themselves. It is not relevant to the discussion with outsiders. I think most people come to the conviction that the Bible is, in fact, what it claims to be the Word of God as a result of engaging the text and becoming having it change them and having that the text lead them to a saving faith in Christ, and then the rest comes as part of the package. I don't think that people are actually independently convinced that the Bible isn't in the inspired Word of God. That is, this is a step in the argument. Okay, here are my arguments for inspiration. Okay, you got that? Great. Now let's go from there. That is not the way it usually happens. Ask yourself the question, do you believe the Bible is the inspired Word of God? And if your answer is yes, ask yourself how you came to believe that. I bet you it wasn't because somebody gave you 5 or 6 points in favor of the proposition. It was as a result of engaging that living word that changed you that you were subjectively, in a sense, convinced. Now, objective arguments can be given. I do that. The Bible Has God Spoken is the title of that talk, and I give 6 reasons. So we can back it up, but I don't think that's the reason that most people believe the Bible is the inspired Word of God. It's something else. I am making my case for Christianity not on the not in virtue of the inspired text, but in virtue of the person of Jesus of Nazareth, for whom we have reliable historical records. So I go to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the independent, individual, separate, primary source historical document witnesses that are a compilation of eyewitness testimony. I don't mean that each was written by an eyewitness. I mean that the ones who wrote it drew from eyewitness testimony about this. Regarding the person of Jesus, that these are historically reliable, and they don't have to be inerrant to be historically reliable. They can be demonstrated to be historically reliable using the basic canons of historical analysis. Now, I'm not going to get into those details. Bill Craig talks about it at length. In his book on reasonable faith, but there are a lot of other places you can find it as well. So I'm making my case on an historically sound text, not on an inerrant text. Is the New Testament reliable in its salient details? Can we trust, by and large, the record that we find there? And I think the answer on analysis is yes, we can. And then given the record, what does that record say? It tells us of a man who made incredible claims about himself and that did incredible things. And one of those incredible things that he did was die on a Roman cross, was sealed in a tomb, and his body was missing 3 days later. And a multitude of people professed that they actually saw him alive, and that changed everything. And they went to the grave with that conviction. Now, given those minimal facts, there are only a couple of possibilities. And when you look at the possibilities, it seems like the best explanation for those minimal facts is that the apostles who saw Jesus, who claimed to see Jesus, actually did. Because the tomb was empty, the body was never found. The Jews had no motivation to hide the body. The Romans had no motivation to hide the body. The disciples had no motivation to hide the body. It cost them their life. Nobody had a motivation to steal the body, yet the body was gone. And so when I'm going to discuss with an atheist, insofar as I bring the scripture in to the discussion in a substantive way, it doesn't mean I won't make reference to certain scriptural claims or I won't use the word in that way. Seeding the conversation with scriptural truth, I might, but I'm not trying to build my case in a Bible they don't believe in. I'm going to build it on the historical reliability of the Gospels. A third thing that I want to do to an atheist is I want to ask him, listen, who is challenging because he sees some problems there. The Bible's just written by men and he's dismissing it. I want to ask him this question. Write this down if you like, but it's not hard to remember. Do you have any books in your library? The atheist says that book was just written by men and is dismissive of its content. Okay, great. Do you have any books in your library? Of course. Well, then, what manner of creature authored those texts? Monkeys? Aliens? Human beings? Yes, you have books written by human beings in your own library. You haven't toss them in the trash can because they were written by men. Therefore, you must believe that human beings, even though fallible, are capable of communicating things that are reliable and true, right? So even if the Bible is written by men, and even if it doesn't satisfy your criterion of inerrancy, isn't it still the case that it could tell you true things about the world? And indeed, isn't it still possible, in principle, for it to be right on its characterization of the way the world actually is, at least in its broad strokes? God and Jesus and man and sin and heaven and hell and souls and demons and all, isn't that possible? Of course it is. We do not require an inerrant text for that purpose. So that's my last point. Couldn't it be true, even if there might be errors? The purpose here, friends, is to put you at ease when this particular kind of challenge is presented to you. If you are just tossing the Bible out as the inspired word of God and you're just saying that, which is you're welcome to do that, but you're going to get pushback. Unless you are very clever and kind of making your case for the inspiration of the text, I think you're going to be playing catch up the whole conversation, just like this young lady was doing. If you're making your case in a different way, and I'm not saying abandoning the Bible completely, I'm just saying about being shrewd. That's what I'm talking about. And you could be taking biblical notions or even biblical verses, if you like, and weaving them into your conversation with an atheist judiciously so the truth can have its impact without setting yourself up for a fall. Tell the atheist, well, I'm not trying to argue that right now. I want to talk about God, not the Bible. And if you want to talk about the Bible, let's talk about Jesus. You know, the early church didn't have a Bible. Now, the Jews had a Bible, but the Gentiles didn't have the Jewish Bible. What they had was the testimony of the apostles and the teaching of the apostles. And over time, their New Testament Bible grew as more things were written. But what did they have? They had a testimony of a risen Christ and the content of the teaching of his life. And they believed the historical claims of Jesus of Nazareth, and that changed everything. And the fact is, even the atheists have books in his library that he trusts as being helpful, useful, reliable, truthful, even though they're not inerrant, even though they were only written by men, even though they might have, and in fact do have in many cases, mistakes or errors, doesn't undermine the truthfulness. So it could be the case that the Christian worldview writ large characterized in the biblical documents could still be true, even if we don't satisfy the atheist's demand for scriptural or textual perfection. That's all I'm saying. Dodge that one. Sidestep it. It's not the issue. We can discuss about inerrancy among us, but don't let that get in the way of having meaningful discussions with your friends who are atheists or who otherwise don't share your convictions. All right, time for a break, and I'll jump into your calls when I return on Stand to Reason.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study The Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order the Bible Fast Forward.
All right, back with you, Stand to Reason. A lot of callers on board, so I'm going to jump right in. And here is Denny in Knoxville, Tennessee. Denny, I was there 2 weeks ago.
That's right. Really enjoyed having you.
Oh, you were part of the group, weren't you?
I was. I met you after the second service.
Uh-huh. Well, that's fabulous.
Well, you sparked a lot of interest in me as far as being able to intelligently discuss Christianity with non-believers.
Great.
Because I'm surrounded by several.
Uh-huh.
And I'm anxious to learn more. I have some questions for you that I'd like to hear your answers to.
Okay.
They're questions that I've had people ask that I really have no good way of answering, and
sure.
I hope maybe you can help me out.
Okay. Glad to do so.
Okay. One of them is, what happens when babies die? Mm. Do they go to heaven? And how does Scripture support your answer on that?
Yeah. Okay, first thing I'll say, and I would say this, the answer I'm going to give you is the same answer and in the same way that I would give it to a non-Christian
right,
who is challenging
right. That's
me.
That's what I want.
The first thing that I'll say is that Scripture does not address it directly. It does
okay.
not speak to it directly. Okay.
Okay.
Now, you might, if you talk to somebody else on this issue, they might draw you back to 2 Samuel, I think, and then point out that David was concerned about his child through Bathsheba when the child was sick and was fasting. And when the child died, he washed his face and got on with his business. And people ask, what's up with that? And he said, well, I can't bring the baby back from the dead. I will go to him. He won't come to me. Now, they would sometimes read into that. It means that, well, David's going to heaven, and he's going to see his baby in heaven.
Right.
I don't think that's what it means. I think he means the baby just went to the grave. He's not going to come out of the grave. I'm going to go into the grave. So I don't want to read too much into that. I would not use that as a kind of proof text. I'm going to give you another line of thinking. I think that the children that die before they are properly accountable for their behavior, that is before what's often called the age of accountability, are going to be with the Lord. And the reason I say that, and I know that in my doctrine, which is classical Christian doctrine, all who are born, human beings are born into sin. We're born fallen. We don't fall when we first sin. We're already fallen, which is why we first sin. I don't think that we are held responsible for our actions until we live out that sin. And part of the reason is, and this is going to have a proof text, my evidence, my scriptural evidence is Revelation 20, where all mankind is brought before the great white throne judgment, and they are judged according to their deeds. According to their deeds.
Okay.
Now, if a child is before the age of accountability, that child does not have accountable misdeeds against God. Now, what of the sin of Adam? I'm going to wager that God forgives that sin of Adam as an act of divine elective mercy. That is, he chooses to forgive. I will forgive who I will forgive, a kind of mentality. And I think God will forgive them. The basis for their forgiveness will still be Christ, but they are innocent in terms of their behavior.
Makes sense.
Yeah. It's not a knockdown, drag out. It's a speculation, but I think it's a meritorious speculation. And let me give you a book you can read that's a very small one if you want to pick it up.
Sure.
And the book is called When a Baby Dies, and the author is Ron Nash, N-A-S-H. Now, Ron Nash is gone. He died 7 or 8 years ago, but he's a great Christian thinker and teacher, and that little book basically outlines what I just offered, but in more depth, okay?
Okay.
So there's one down, three to go.
All right. Well, the next one sort of builds on what you just answered, and that is, at what stage of development would you say people are actually accountable for their actions?
Yeah, well, we don't, when you say did you mean stage or age or either?
Well, not necessarily age, but stage of development. In other words, when has a person developed mentally or spiritually or whatever that God could hold them accountable?
Well, I'm
going to
give, I'll give you the answer that one of the prophets gave to God when God asked him a hard question, and the prophet said to God, "Well, God, you know."
Well, that's true.
So I don't know when that age is, and I would say that it differs for different people. Some kids are clever early on, some are slower, and some never get there because of impeded mental development. There is such an age, I think, though, because in Isaiah chapter 7, you know the famous passage about the virgin giving birth? That's 7:14. Mm-hmm. Well, if you go down two more verses, it says, before the boy will know enough, and here it's talking about an actual historical child that is to be born in the generation in the time of Isaiah. He says, before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. Now, all I'm keying in there is the phrase, before the lad will know enough to refuse evil and choose good. This identifies that from the prophet Isaiah that there is a time before which one does not know enough to refuse evil and choose the good. And it, whenever that time happens to be, and God is the one who's got to make the distinction, he's the only one that has to know. It's not our choice anyway, so it's not our problem, it's his, so he's the one who knows. I don't know when that time is.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right.
I like that answer. Okay, the other one, and you hear this a lot, if Jesus is the only way to heaven, what happens to all those people who have never been exposed to the gospel?
Well, this one is a little bit more tricky, and I can't give you a full-fledged answer. I could just give you a quickie. I have a whole talk called "The Heathen and the Unknown God" that's available at str.org, and which I have to pace this whole thing out. But I'll tell you. Let me identify the problem. The problem of thinking about this. People are thinking that if Jesus is the only way and the message of the only Jesus doesn't reach certain people, then they're going to hell by an accident of geography or something like that, or time.
Or history. Yeah.
Of history. Yeah. There you go. Thanks. That's what I was after. Geography or history.
Mm-hmm.
That these are innocent people that otherwise would have gone to heaven except for this accident of geography or history. And I want to make it really clear to them that nobody goes to hell because they just didn't happen to hear about Jesus. They are punished, and this is also in Revelation 20, according to their own deeds. That is, they are not assessed with regards to whether or not they heard and or rejected. They are assessed based on their behavior before a holy God. Now,
well, no, I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard that. But
this
they
is
did something they knew was wrong. In other words, they broke their own law.
There's lots of ways to put this. Paul covers a couple of them in Romans 1 and Romans 2, and that would be an example of that. They knew God already, but they didn't honor him as such, but they suppressed the truth and unrighteousness. Others, he said, and look, if you just make your own standard, the standard by which you judge other people, you're going to get nailed by that standard yourself. You don't do the things that you say others should do. So the Jew has the law, and he still breaks the law. So he's looking at all these characterizations, all these circumstances, and he concludes nobody has an excuse. There's none righteous, not any.
Well, so how can anybody that hasn't accepted Christ go to heaven then? Because,
they can't.
So in other words, all these masses of people that never heard about Christ, they don't go to heaven.
Well, as a simple response, your answer is yes, but you have worded it in a way that kind of conveys the wrong idea. Because, yes, there is a one-to-one correlation, in my book at least, between those who never heard and those who don't get saved. Okay? If they didn't hear, they're not going to get saved. But the reason that they are lost is not because they never heard, and that's the misunderstanding. The reason that they lost is because they were rebellious sinners against God.
We all were.
Yes, we all were. So let me ask you a question. Does God owe anybody salvation?
No.
He does?
Does he owe anybody salvation?
That was the question.
Well,
is he obliged?
He doesn't owe any of us anything.
That's right. Is he obligated to save anybody? Is he obligated?
No.
No, he's not. Did he save any of the angels that fell?
No.
No. So God is not obligated. When he does save anybody, it's an act of his what?
His will.
His will, but more specifically, his grace. Grace,
right.
Grace is undeserved.
Unmerited favor,
exactly. So and this, the trick here is to get you to think about this in the right way.
Okay.
It isn't, no, here's the way I'm going to put it. Nobody goes to hell because he never heard of Jesus. Period, end of issue. Nobody goes to hell for that reason.
Okay.
He is punished by God because that person has rebelled against God when he should not have rebelled. He has rebelled against God when there was enough information for him to know otherwise. And that's what Romans 1 is all about. Even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God. They became futile in their speculations. Their foolish heart was darkened, and they exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for that of creatures and four-footed beings and the like. So they worshiped the creature rather than the creator. God holds them responsible for that. Did they hear about Jesus? No, but that's not relevant at this point. They heard about the Father. Everybody has heard about the Father. And put the word heard in quotations here. Now, this is a hard saying, and I think because we're Americans, we think in terms of fairness, and everybody should get exactly the same, that God is not under the obligation of giving everybody exactly the same. He cannot punish the innocent. That he can't do, and he will not punish the innocent. But the guilty, yes, he can punish. He should punish the guilty. They deserve it. Even if they didn't hear Jesus about Jesus, if they are still guilty, they still deserve it. Let me ask it the question a different way.
Okay.
Let's say you commit a crime in the state of Tennessee where you live. And you're guilty and the judge goes to deliver sentence. Does the judge first have to offer you a free pardon before he is justified in declaring sentence?
No,
of course not. Same thing is true with God. God doesn't have to offer a pardon if somebody's guilty before he's justified in sentencing them.
Well, so do you think it's just sort of an excuse to avoid Christianity when non-believers say, oh, well, I couldn't follow a God that would doom all these natives to hell because they never heard about Jesus.
See, but there you've just misstated it. They are saying that because they don't understand the point. The point isn't that they're going to hell because of the accident of hearing. They accidentally didn't hear it. No, it's because all of these people in question have thoroughly rebelled against God all of their lives, and they're going to be punished for their crimes against him. That's why. And this is a mistake. I mean, a lot of Christians have I think, contributed to this confused thinking, unfortunately.
It's hard. I mean, and I understand. I think what you're saying is it's important to clarify to them that God has his prerogative to send any rebellious person to hell.
Yes.
Because it's his prerogative.
Yeah, well, it's not just his prerogative. You're right about that. But they believe the same notion when it comes to the state executing its justice. That's why I asked you the question, if you broke the law in Tennessee, would the judge be obliged to give you a pardon before he issued sentence, offer you a pardon? No. But this is kind of what people are saying. Well, they didn't get a chance to hear about the pardon, so therefore they shouldn't be allowed to be punished.
So they shouldn't have to be punished.
Yeah, that's all backwards.
Well, that's a good question to ask then. That's a good example give someone.
That's why I asked it.
Good.
That's the Columbo method right there. I'm using Columbo number 3, using a question to make a point.
I like that.
Okay, good. You know what we're going to have to – you've got one other – we got 3 down and 1 to go. Let's go through that quickly because I got to go to break and get some other callers. So the fourth one is, what do you think of church discipline, right?
That was – yeah, I was going to ask that. What about people who object to church discipline? I have actually my daughter who has decided that she would not even consider joining my church because one of her friends left the church because their friend – had been basically thrown out of the church.
Hmm. Well, did the person who was basically thrown out deserve to be basically thrown out?
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
No question in my mind.
Right.
In my mind.
Look at your daughter. Your daughter would probably throw somebody out of her own house if she was a roommate that was living in a way that was inconsistent with the values of the rules of the house. They would just say, you know, go find another place to live because you're not welcome here anymore. This is not the way we do things.
It
isn't just the church that is supposed to it isn't just that churches discipline. All communities discipline in some manner. The thing in the case of the church discipline, it is obliged to discipline because there is a transcendent moral code that we are to be living by if we claim to be followers of Christ. And if we don't live by that, we don't just hurt ourselves, we hurt others in our community. And this is in 1 Corinthians 5. We are obliged to do that. Now, I'm just talking to you, if it's your daughter who doesn't want to go to church because of somebody else's discipline of another person, well then, she's got to make her own decision as an adult. But church discipline is obligatory in church communities. Circumstances justify it, and there's a way to do it too. So,
I think a lot has to do with it. She's not a Christian, and her idea is church is supposed to just welcome everybody with open arms and love on them, and everybody sins. Mm-hmm. So, how do you decide which person has sinned so much?
Well, that's something that the Scripture has something to say about it. If a person is living in egregious sin and is not open to changing, then they don't belong in that community. The community has requirements, and this is something you explained to your daughter. The community has requirements for membership, just like any other community. You want to join a political party? Well, they have a platform. If you don't agree with their platform, then join another party that you agree with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if your daughter had roommates, they would have some at least implicit rules. And if the implicit rules kept being broken flagrantly, then your daughter would probably ask her roommate to move on. Then this kind of thing happens all the time. That's kind of like roommate discipline, if you want to put it that way.
Right. No, that makes sense.
Yeah. So
I just don't have your quick wit and response.
Well, I don't know that my responses are always quick or witty, but sometimes I've thought about these things before, and then I know how to respond. But
right.
Here's what you might do. You might try to find circumstances just that are familiar to your daughter, in which people are making decisions about belonging. You know, mm-hmm. you shouldn't be allowed to belong. Hey, let's look at what look what's happening to the Boy Scouts.
Mm-hmm.
The Boy Scouts are getting kicked out of all kinds of things because of their view about homosexuality. I don't know what mm-hmm. your daughter's view on that is, but if she's not a Christian and she tends to be, you know, kind of going with the crowd, she's probably, in some sense, pro-homosexual or at least sympathetic to those who are kicking the Boy Scouts out.
Right.
So why is it okay to kick the Boy Scouts out? Well, because they're homophobes, she'll say. All right, well, mm-hmm. let's just say for the moment they are. So then you believe in organizational discipline then, right? In other words, they're mm-hmm. not keeping the rules that you think are right, so you want to kick them out. Well, how is that different from church discipline?
Aha, uh-huh. Very good.
All right. Okay, try that.
I will.
All righty.
Thank you.
Denny,
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure talking with you, and say hi to all my friends in Knoxville.
I will do that. Thank you, Greg.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Let's see. I just pushed Landon's button by accident. So, Landon, I hope you call back, please, and in Mobile, Alabama. Ouch, ouch, ouch. There's plenty of open lines, so give it another shot. We'll go to break, and then we'll take Matt and then Landon if we can get him back on board. Stay with us.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STR TV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STR TV, Christianity worth thinking about.
All right, friends. Greg Kokel with you every Tuesday night live, wherever you happen to be getting your tape-delayed show. Tuesday is when I broadcast. 4 to 7, 855-243-9975 is the number. And let's see, Kansas City, Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I'm a little embarrassed because I bumped Landon there, but he's back on board. We'll talk to him in a few minutes.
Fantastic. Hey, I usually don't get the opportunity to listen live, so this is a nice treat for me.
Good.
And it's actually been, you and I talked on the show, I think it was 7 or 8 years ago.
Huh.
And at that point I had called in asking about when it was the right time to decide to either stay with a church that that wasn't going the direction that you felt that
uh-huh.
it should.
Uh-huh.
And we actually did end up, following our conversation and some circumstances, we did end up leaving. We're in a wonderful fellowship now.
Oh, good. And, was that what I told you to do, or did I say to stay? And you ignored me and did something smarter. I don't know.
No, you were very encouraging the whole way, and I really appreciated your insight. And I think we really had to get to the point that we realized that there wasn't a whole lot that we were going to be able to do to change mm-hmm. the situation as it stood, mm-hmm. but we ended up in a great fellowship with we attribute this all to God, that it was His providence that led us
mm-hmm.
to the church that we're at now and have been blessed by it. And the person who I was able to make contact with and totally providentially happened to be a person who had also, he and his family had also previously been at the church that we were then at.
Huh.
So, just, we had a, I called him out of the blue. He had something up on his website that just led me to call him and have this similar kind of conversation with him.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on the phone, total strangers practically, and we had seen one another at church before,
uh-huh.
but ended up just having an hour and a half conversation, and it ended with him saying that he was going to pray for me and our family,
yeah.
and invited us to the church that we've been at now for about 6.5 years.
Wow, that's good. Well, I hope this call turns out as good as the last call did.
I have high hopes. So one of the things, and the reason why I brought up some of the back history, was that one of the things that we were looking at the time, parents of very, very young kids, what was the situation that we were facing with them being in the life of the church?
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to be dealt with on Sunday mornings and things like that, and their opinions kind of all over the map, and you know, I think people find different situations that work best for their families.
Uh-huh.
So we were looking at some of those issues with little kids, and in making the switch to the church that we're at now, we have the kids with us almost all the time. The mm-hmm. real littles, you know, we have a place where, you know, mom or dad can listen to the sermon through the through the audio system.
Yeah, through the glass or whatever, so the kids aren't making a fuss and disturbing other people, but you still can be together as a family.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's good.
So our kids have been hearing the gospel in under really wonderfully sound expository preaching.
Great.
Every Sunday since they've, as far back as really they can remember.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, we homeschool, so we have the kids with us in that. There's a Bible-based curriculum that we're taking them through, so they're saturated in not only our conversation as mom and dad around the things of Christ and being grounded in the Christian teaching, but also having that modeled for them in the way that our church lives in
Christ. Well, that is a great 1-2 punch, so to speak.
So that kind of brings us to kind of up to today. So mm-hmm. as I said, it was, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, and the kids have grown up considerably since then.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're watching our kids interacting with the other kids in the neighborhood. We are one of two or three families in our immediate neighborhood who profess Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm watching my kids have conversations and getting into some deep water for them in just having these conversations with the other kids in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter, who we're really watching her particularly. She's our middle child.
Mm-hmm.
We're really watching her particularly for more signs of spiritual fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in that wonderfully delicate time.
How old is she again?
She is 10.
Okay.
So so we're watching her, and she is concerned about the things of Christ.
Okay.
She wants to be in her Bible more.
Mm-hmm.
She's as part of their conversations, they have taken up the cause of talking about Jesus
mm-hmm.
and the Bible with the kids in the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
which is great and scary at the same time, because uh-huh. they're getting into situations where they're, you know, some of the kids in the neighborhood are kind of hostile to the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
They think that they, and I know that you've talked about this on the program before, that this is, that to them, they think that this is Francis Schaeffer's upper story leap, that faith is just, you know, you make up something that you like to believe, and that's your thing.
Is that,
but
you mean other 10-year-olds?
Reality.
Other 10-year-olds are making this kind of characterization of faith, or are these older kids?
I'm kind of reading into it,
uh-huh.
but the other kids in the neighborhood are starting in with, well, you don't even know where we come from. We meaning humanity. Mm-hmm. My daughter misunderstood at first as well. You know, mommy and daddy. Well, no. The other kid clarified the conversation.
And this is evolutionary.
And said, no, us. You know, people. Where does life come from?
Yeah.
And very quick on the heels of that, our youngest, who's 8, she said, "Well, Adam and Eve."
Mm-hmm.
And but of course, then for the other kid, it's like, "Oh, game over. I won."
Yeah. Uh huh.
So they're jumping to the answers, and we're having conversation about this. Actually, we're a little bit late for Bible study last Wednesday, mm-hmm. because we were having a dinner table conversation, and I was basically sounding like you on the radio to my kids, and starting to talk to them about the Columbo tactic.
Yeah.
And so that really led to the question that I've taken way too much time to set up.
Okay.
In dealing with the kids, then how do, you know, so age wise, we're between 13 years old on the upper end and 8 years old on the lower end, mm-hmm. for our family.
Mm-hmm.
But starting to lead them into things like the Ambassador Basic curriculum,
mm-hmm.
or specifically walking them through tactics,
yeah.
or the audio program for tactics and defending the faith.
I have a thought about this, and it's actually something that's been gelling for a while and coming together in a really nice way for me, because I'm having to think lately about just strategically what we want to accomplish in our second 20 years and how we want to focus our efforts. And I realize that we not only have to worry about the generation that's already here, your generation, my generation, mm-hmm. adult generation, but also the next generation, the rising generation, okay? And
right.
that would be your and my kids, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, my girls go to, you probably know this, a classical school that's modeled after the Trivium model.
Yeah.
And without getting into a lot of detail about this, if you think of three stages of development, you think of the grammar school stage and the middle school stage and the high school stage. And here's the three ways of looking at those stages. The grammar school stage, children focus on particulars. The middle school stage, which is called the logic stage in the Trivium approach, they focus on the coherence of things. So first you have the particulars, then you have the coherence of those things, how these things fit together in larger systems. It's not just logic proper, although that's part of it, but it is the logic of the system, okay? And then you have the rhetoric stage, which is high school, and this is the communication of the things. How do we engage and talk about these things? Now, I think these are very valid ways of looking at developmental stages, and they turn out to dictate, maybe not dictate is the right word, inform, the I think, the things that we communicate to our children. So I have a 6-year-old who's in first grade. She's obviously in the grammar stage. Mm-hmm. I don't want to try to force upon her any kind of systematic way of looking at theology,
right.
Because she doesn't have the developmental capability for that. I just want her to get the particulars. God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection, yay, you know, the credo or the 12 major historical things of the nation of Israel, events of the nation of Israel. She can memorize things, particulars. So our investment with, I think, as parents and our children at that stage is going to be with particulars. Memorize lots of stuff. You don't have to understand it. Just memorize it, okay? Next, though, in the logic stage, this is where my first daughter is at. She's 9. And she's in this, she's just approaching the middle school now, and she's just starting to bring things in coherence. So we were sitting down with the book I, Resurrection, for example, the other day, and she likes it because of the pictures, and she reads all the things in there. But it turns out to be apologetics in favor of the resurrection, and it's really a fabulous book. Doug, I'll think of his last name in a minute. I'm having one of those moments. Was the author of this, and so we were. So she was talking about these different ways of trying to explain away the resurrection, like somebody stole the body, and she was just bringing this up, and so it gave me an opportunity to quiz her a little bit, and I did yesterday. What are the options of stealing the body? Oh, wait, it could be the could have been the Romans, could have been the Jews, could have been the disciples, but this doesn't make sense because of this. So she's just now starting to talk about those things, and so I'm going to encourage her more in the coherence of those. Now, the rhetoric stage is the older stage when they start engaging more aggressively conceptually with people and try to be persuasive. That's beyond her right now. She can talk a little bit, but I don't, you know, it's going to be difficult, I think, at this stage to try to give her too much. I could teach her how to ask questions. What do you mean by that? And how did you come to that conclusion? But when you're dealing with a thing like Adam and Eve, and versus the Darwinian evolution, this requires conceptual apparatus that's much more sophisticated. Okay, and so I'm not even gonna try to make much headway in that at that point, because for my daughter to be able to manage that kind of conversation, she requires a whole bunch more knowledge than she already has. So the thinking that I've been doing lately, Matt, about this is to be thinking in those categories: grammar, middle school, high school, the grammar stage, the logic stage, and the rhetoric stage, that is the particulars, the coherence of the particulars, and the expression of the particulars, and then try to invest in my children in a way that's consistent with those developmental stages. So for my impulse with your 9-year-old is not going to be how to equip her, or your 10-year-old, to equip her to engage rhetorically this conversation about Adam and Eve and whatever. Because she's not going to have the capability to do that. There might be other simpler things that she can work with. Why do we believe in God? Because God is the best explanation for things. Moral God gives us moral law. An intelligent God gives us a hummingbird that can make a nest, like I was talking about at the beginning of this hour. That there's anything here is because there was someone who caused this world to come into existence. So that's a very modest cosmological argument. But I won't use those terms, probably. I'm just going to try to get them to think about the concepts in the logic stage, in the middle school stage. Here's how this coheres. Here's how this fits together. And it's interesting. It wasn't until the middle school stage, the logic stage, that my eldest asked me a question: how do we know God exists? And then I began to give her a little bit of that. So there's, Matt, I don't know if that's everything, but it's a place to start, okay?
Absolutely. And I think it's really helpful to go back and think about that, particularly. I mean, we've got a homeschool convention coming up in the next like 3 or 4 weeks, and I know that the classical education models are going to be front and center.
Sure,
and
yeah.
So that's going to help me to think through and maybe even look for some things that I might be able to pick up to help equip them at the places
that they are. Good, Matt. Just think of those three categories, and that's what I've found to really help me out right now. So they'll guide you as well. Great talking to you, Mark. Coming up in hour number 3 here on Stand to Reason. Thanks. Final hour here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host, and committed here to challenging you and helping you think carefully about the things that really matter. Since I last hour really rudely punched Landon down by accident, I guess, so maybe I'm not morally responsible since I didn't intend it, I'm going to bring him up right away. Landon, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I dropped you by accident. I meant to push somebody else's button, and off you went. So I'm glad you got right back on board, and there was room on the line, so you're able to get in.
Yeah, thanks. Well, and it's funny, because the last time I called you, it cut me off and had to call back again. I mean, I can take a hint, buddy.
Twice in a row. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I'm really sorry. I'll have to be really careful next time around that I don't get a hat trick here, you know.
Yeah, that's okay, man. When I was calling the screener, I was trying to figure out the best way to try to condense the question. But it basically goes along lines like this, Greg. In light of Nelson Mandela's death a couple months ago, there were several individuals, public figures, Christians, and the like that was endorsing the individual and, was very supportive of what he had represented and everything. And it seems as though from individuals like Dr. Peter Hammons of Frontline Ministry and some others that he actually, when he took control, had brought in more oppression, was very communist, brought in abortion laws and change marriage to allow homosexual marriage and things like that. And
same-sex
marriage. My question, yeah, same-sex marriage, that's right. And so my question is specific. How could a Christian in good conscience endorse an individual that supported, such activities? And I guess a broader question is, how do we as Christians take stewardship over media information? Is it ignorance that Christians endorsed him? Is it public pressure that if you speak against someone like Nelson Mandela or even a controversial figure like, Martin Luther King, does it paint you as racist even though, let's just say I'm opposed to his adultery and his plagiarizing his speeches and things like that? Is that, I can still be opposed adamantly against racial segregation and it doesn't mean I support apartheid because I'm opposed to Nelson Mandela. How do we as Christians navigate that? How do we filter information we're getting? Any kind of tips on things like that?
Well, there's a couple things going on here. One of them is how we navigate opposing someone who's popular for certain reasons without being labeled inappropriately labeled regarding that person, like you mentioned. If I think that Nelson Mandela was not a good man, does that mean that I'm pro-apartheid? Well, it doesn't at all, but that does not mean that people won't take advantage of your comments about Mandela, or King for that matter, and then try to illicitly paint you with that brush. This kind of thing happens all the time. It happens all the time, particularly if you're a public figure. That is, you stand against something for the reasons that you give and the principles that you give, and it is very, very easy for people to mischaracterize that. A perfect example of this is the Arizona law that was recently vetoed by the governor that had to do with religious freedom relative to same-sex marriages and the like. Now, the reason that that law was first passed and sent to the governor had to do with problems with people's religious freedoms being overlooked with regards to same-sex marriage. And it seems to me, since we have a first freedom in the First Amendment, that such laws securing the freedoms of the First Amendment shouldn't have to be passed. It strikes me that the amendment is adequate. But as it turns out, you know, if you want to argue based on the First Amendment, you're going to have to litigate all the way up to the Supreme Court. And so maybe passing laws in a state to protect your First Amendment rights is a good idea. But from the get-go, that was called the anti-gay bill, even though nothing about homosexuality was mentioned in the entire piece. And even though the things that people claimed would be the inappropriate fallout, all of this discrimination against gay people in the public square that would happen, turns out that those things are already legal in the state of Arizona. You know, so short story here is there is nothing that is going to protect you from being having your statements or your point of views abused by people on the other side from you illicitly. And the only defense against that is to be able to see it and point it out and call it what it is. But as you know, a lie gets around the world, halfway around the world, before truth gets its boots on. So we're up against some difficult foes in that regard. Defending against that kind of stuff, I think, is going to be hard. Now, your other question, though, had to do with your judgment in dealing with people in positions of leadership and what should you believe. You know, I had heard kind of – is that right? Did I get that right?
Yeah. I mean, you're in the same ballpark, because there's certain public figures that hold high positions either in seminaries. They're either seminary presidents or professors, mm-hmm. or they run ministries, and especially with Nelson Mandela and – you know, even in the case with Dr. King, it was these two individuals are so universally accepted as great heroes that any opposition or any voice that is contrary to that is looked down upon so much. But, you know, given the examples I gave before, you know, how would I discern? Is it public pressure? Do they feel that? I mean, I'm not calling him a coward. I understand that, you know, you got to play the game sometimes, I guess. But is it,
you want to be shrewd. You want to be shrewd and you want to be careful. But what's the best way to go about that? Well, let me just toss a couple of things out that you can think about. For one, it's always a little bit risky to take somebody who is revered in some way and then after he's died to trash him. I mean, it's a little bit of kind of bad manners, okay? Now, sometimes it may be necessary, but we want to make sure that the things that we're objecting to are really substantive in the big picture. So let's just take Reverend Martin Luther King. There's been a habit to call him doctor, and I did that too, as you just did. But it's a way of – I think it plays into the secularization of this man. And he may have had a checkered moral life in some ways, but those things seem to me to pale in comparison to his contribution. So in that particular instance, I would not want to make a big deal about these more private peccadilloes when, in fact, his public contribution was so noble. When it comes to someone like Nelson Mandela, I think maybe the picture is a bit different, because in his case, it wasn't private peccadilloes. It was policy issues. I don't know what to say about him, because I don't know that I have a good grasp of all the facts. I had heard some very ugly things for a long time about his communist leanings and about the behavior of his wife, you know, and the necklacing, you know, with the tires and all of that. And it's, that got mixed in there and other things. And then after he died, there were people whose opinion that I respected, who wrote articles praising the man's Christian convictions and his Christian contribution. And then
that's what I'm talking about. Look how confusing that is, man.
Well, the question there has to do with a matter of facts. And so it's going to require that in that situation with Mandela, for example, you're going to have to check more things out. And the internet allows you to do that fairly quickly. You can find out what it is that people are actually – what are the facts of the matter here, you know? And peer review is the only way to get that done. You got to check facts on both sides and just kind of come to your own conclusion based on all of the information. I felt a little chastised when I heard these things regarding his alleged Christian convictions. And I felt chastised because I felt I had kind of gone along, well, he's a bad guy, of course, because I know people, conservatives, call him a leftist, so he must be a bad guy. And so I had a little bit of an impulse to believe that and not to take into consideration any of these things. And then when I heard all these other things, doesn't mean I believed every single detail of it, but it was a different side. Now, if you look in Proverbs for today, I think it's the 18th, I didn't read the second half of the chapter, but in the first half, but I caught a verse there, though I was reading the first half today, and I think in the second half is the verse that said, the first person who pleads his case seems just until another comes and examines him. There's wisdom in that. That is, when you get the first characterization of somebody, especially if the person is, you know, on your side politically, we'll just say, it's real easy to just say, yeah, that's right. That seems right. I'm on that side. And then when you get another source of information, then it adds some dimension there. And you say, hey, well, maybe it's not quite as clear as I thought. And that's the impression that I got here. Now, if I was going to pursue this more about Mandela, I'd want to read more. I'd want to read a number of different people to find out where does the truth lie here with regards to this man? And if it turns out that this man was in fact someone at one point in his life who had done all of these things when he was in power, well, then that raises questions for me. If he was a Christian, when did he become a Christian? Later in life or earlier in life? Did he have a Christian testimony that was really like a lot of politicians have? Yeah, I'm a Christian and I go to church, and so I've satisfied that requirement for my election, you know, and then maybe later on got real serious about it. But earlier on was a Christian by name only, and therefore his policies didn't reflect a consistent worldview. I don't know. I don't know what's true about Nelson Mandela. I just know that there's conflicting stories on this. So if somebody claims to be a Christian and consistently passes legislation or is party to legislation that seems decidedly inconsistent with a proper Christian worldview, then I am going to question whether that person – I'm going to question that person's commitments. If there's a politician who says basically, well, I'm a Christian, but I'm not saying other people should be Christians because Jesus is my way of salvation, but I'm not saying he has to be salvation for anybody else, well – and they're talking theologically, not in terms of religious freedoms. I know that person does not understand Christianity. They do not understand Jesus if they've said that. And then if they vote pro-abortion consistently and they are in favor of same-sex marriage, which Jesus would not have been because it is a violation of God's original standard, then I'm going to ask myself, well, I won't ask myself the question. I will be progressively convinced this person is not a follower of Jesus. I don't care how much that person says he loves the poor and wants to do things for the poor. They're not followers of Jesus.
And that is a good point. And your work with philosophy and everything as far as how postmodernism and the revisionist history, this anti-imperialist, anti-colonial sentiment that seems to force everything into racial categories, that even though, you know, my ethnic background is English and Cherokee, that therefore I'm not allowed to speak against anybody who's African American, regardless, or that just makes me racist. I think that's maybe what makes these issues a little tougher.
But notice the person who does that though is reacting simply in virtue of skin color, skin color. If you offer a principled objection against some policy of an individual and somebody says, well, that person's black, that makes you a racist, that means the person who charges you with the racism is the one who sees the color, not you.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
It's amazing how frequently those who are champions of a colorblind culture, one would think, based on their political statements, turn out to see everything in terms of race. You cannot escape that. They're not colorblind. They can't see anything but race. And if you differ from them, why is it when they differ from you that they are not against the white race? Why is that? It's so self-serving, these objections. If you want to disprove an idea, you've got to challenge. You have to say something about the idea, not about the believer of the idea. The minute you talk about the believer of the idea, you've changed the subject.
Yeah, and I'm okay talking about good that somebody did or bad, understanding that everybody is complex, everybody has layers. I could look at, say, I think a good figure as a conservative, reformed believer, you take Jonathan Edwards, for example. I've gleaned a lot from his brilliant writings, but he was also a slave owner. I don't have a problem saying he had sin in his life. I have a Christian worldview that allows for that. That was wrong. It was wrong for him to own slaves, and I don't know why in his theology and looking at the scriptures he didn't know better as to not do that, but he didn't. And that's, I'm okay. I don't need perfect people to follow. That's not what I'm
That's right.
After,
but we also don't know the manner in which, the manner in which he dealt with the slaves, too. If he treated them as servants or he treated them in a subhuman way. I don't know about that. But John Wesley had a terrible marriage. He was a great, great Christian preacher, but he utterly and completely and with totality neglected his wife, who hated him when he died. So you're right. We all have feet made of clay, and the good is mixed with the bad. But we ought to be free to be able to say that about Charles Wesley, or say Chuck Colson. He was a great man, someone I knew and worked with a number of times, and yet I was very, very uncomfortable with his evangelical and Catholics together and that movement. We can make common cause on moral issues, but not on salvation, gospel-related theological issues, because the divide is too great at that point. So is it wrong for me to say that about Chuck? Well, it would have been in politic for me to say it the week after he died. But if we're making an assessment of the life of the man, those kinds of things, I think it's fair to take them into consideration. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate it, buddy.
All right, Landon. Thanks for calling back when I dropped you by accident. And I hope I don't make it a three for next time you call.
All right, man. Thanks.
All right. Take care. Let's go to break, and we'll be back with more calls on Stand to Reason.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors. And your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that'll help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that will help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a 4-part template that will help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the Gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the Gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the Gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Greg Kokel here and with you every week. For 3 hours, of what I hope for you is clear thinking Christianity. We have Zeb in San Antonio on board. Zeb, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg.
Hi.
That was really, really fast. I was not expecting to get on this soon.
Well, you know, I could have waited a little longer. I'll put you on hold to talk about something else for a while if you want. What happened is I kind of petered out on callers here towards the end of the show. And this has happened a little bit recently, not last week, the week before, though. So anybody listening to the show who wants to call in, you may get in fairly easily the last hour if you're not able to get in the earlier hours. So try the end of the second hour, early part of the third hour, and chances are you'll get in the queue. Just like you did, Zeb. What is Zeb? Is Zeb short for something?
Zebulun.
Zebulun.
Yeah.
I think, did you ever see the movie The Man from Snowy River? Or Return from Snowy River? I think there was a Zeb in
it. It was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was. It was a great movie, though. Both of them, Australian. But, okay, Zeb, what's on your mind? How can I help?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to thank you. You've been giving me clarity since 2001.
Wow. 13 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, good. I was just thinking about that. And good. I was driving home, and I listened to your podcast about prayer and your struggles with it. Mm-hmm. And I had just been on a mission trip, and I realized that I was having a lot of those same struggles. So I guess your podcast on struggling with prayer kind of answered my prayer.
Well, that's good. You know, I am... thank you for calling to mention that. And even as I read some others, like C.S. Lewis, for example, I see in their life the similar kind of struggle. That is, it is not unusual for really good Christians to have to fight that or to struggle with it. It's, you know, you talk to some people and it sounds like they're just, they fall into this wonderful thing and they're hours in chatting with God, and it's euphoric, and there's a certain triumphalism with that, and it makes one feel second class because you're not experiencing that. But, you know, there are many other Christians who are good Christians for whom it is a discipline, and I don't know if I said it in that particular broadcast, but I sometimes think of it like jogging, which I don't run anymore because of my back. Now I walk. Hills and stuff like that. But when you start working out, doing anything, my first set of push-ups, you know, is, oh, man, they're the most painful set because you're just getting warmed up. But after you start doing them, I'm walking and I got myself warmed up, and then I'm cranking out my push-ups in sets of 25, boom, 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 because they're coming fast, I'm into it. And I found the same thing in prayer, even driving to the studio today. I didn't want to start praying, but I just stepped into it. I thought of the particular things that I really needed to be addressed, that needed, I said to God, you know, your word says you have not because you ask not, and Lord, I don't want to be guilty of that. And so I'm going to ask you. I have this, this, and this on my mind, friends, some personal issues. But by the time I got into it, just like jogging, it's always easy to stop. Anytime, it's always easy to stop. However, it's not so hard to keep going once you get warmed up.
Mm-hmm.
And when I find that when I get focused a little bit more, and it's all right. I want to keep talking. I want to keep bringing this before the Lord and some other things. So, anyway.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I've noticed that too. And the more I talk to God, the more I have to say, I guess you could say.
Yeah, you got to get through the first 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to be a little bit focused and concentrated. And the first 5 minutes, it's like, you know, just like jogging. You're just getting the kinks out. You're getting warmed up. Once you get into it, you're having a conversation. Here's another way of looking at it. I just thought of this. It's you meet somebody at a party or at a church or whatever, and your first few minutes maybe are a little awkward in conversation. What do you talk about? And then if you're forced to talk more together, maybe you just hit on something. All of a sudden, you get a rhythm, and you're enjoying it now, back and forth. So there's maybe another parallel. The point being, you got to sit down, or you got to start, and you got to You got to push yourself for a little while before you get overcome the momentum of rest in prayer.
That's good. I like that.
Good. So did you have anything particular you wanted to?
I did. I've been listening to, I've listened to many, many times the Decision-Making Will of God, mm-hmm. Both the book and your material on it.
Yeah, the book by Gary Friesen, right.
Yeah. And I was kind of playing devil's advocate with myself to somebody who has the paradigm that the book by Gary Friesen was trying to shift you away from, mm-hmm. to, I guess, the normal way of thinking, the standard way of thinking about God's will.
Well, the contemporary way of thinking. Historically, yeah. I don't think it's the normal way. But yeah.
No, I know it's only a couple hundred years old. But you know how when we look back on our life and we say, okay, I see where God did that and I did that, but when you're going through it, you don't see that.
Right.
I wanted to know, when you're explaining the about God not necessarily having an individual will for you, how do you explain that those things that happen to you looking back are not the individual will that God had for you?
Yeah, okay.
To somebody who doesn't understand necessarily.
Sure. Sure. This is an excellent question, and I'm glad to offer clarification. Let me bring the rest of the listeners up to speed if some people are maybe not familiar with the thing that you're talking about. This is a little bit of an insider's discussion here. I've been teaching since 1982 the concept that is broadly characterized in Gary Friesen, Friesen, Gary Friesen's book, The Decision-Making, the Will of God, that it is not a biblical motif to essentially ask God to make the decisions for you and then let him tell you by hint in a certain way, dropping little hints like open and closed doors and feelings of being led and confirmations and things. These are all details of this other model. The Bible doesn't teach that this is what we're supposed to do. And the way Friesen characterizes it. He said there is no blueprint plan for your life. Our perception or the received tradition in our churches many times is that God has the plan. You have to ask God about the details of the plan, which he then shows you indirectly so that you can then choose the details that fit the plan of his life, of your life. So God, you know, what college should you go to? Well, God knows that. That's part of the plan. So God, what's your will for the school I go to? And then you pray that, and then you watch for the hints, and they are comprised of these things that I just mentioned, feeling led and throwing out a fleece and open doors and closed doors and having confirmation, etc., having a peace about it. And so the case that I make is that this plan or model or means of determining or making decisions is not a biblical model. Okay. Now, whether I'm right or wrong is a different issue, but I'm just laying that out so people know that where you and I are at, Zeb, and what we're talking about. It's so, as Gary puts it, and I would put it too, properly qualified, there is no blueprint for your life. Okay. There is no center of the dot. There's no target that you hit by using these techniques that people describe. But rather, your decisions are up to you, based on the wisdom that we get from Scripture and others and the moral guidance that we see in Scripture. We don't need God telling us what to do. Okay. So then you properly ask, well, wait a minute. We look back on our life and we can actually see all of these things kind of falling into place. And it seems clear that God did have a blueprint for our life. And look at all these things that all fell together that fit this sophisticated plan, so to speak. I could say the same thing about Stand to Reason. I'm here now because I look back over 40 years and I could see all of these things falling into place. So here's my answer to that. And I'm going to answer it by modifying the statement that Gary makes with a phrase. And this is the way I always say it, as I think I always say it when I teach. There is no blueprint plan that you must discover before you can make your decisions. There is no plan the Christian must discover before you can make your decisions. Does God have a plan? Well, in the sovereign sense, certainly he has a plan, but the sovereign plan of God is God's business. As one wag put it, it's none of our business, you know, what God has planned for us. It's his business. And that wag, by the way, was R.C. Sproul. So we rather are obliged to use a different means to make our decisions, and God will work out his sovereign purposes in the process of us using a biblical means, which is God's moral law and wisdom, being expeditious in the decisions that we make. That is not wasting time because the days are evil, but rather making wise decisions that are consistent with God's moral will and consistent with our gifting and things like that. And I go through the details in the talk, Decision-Making the Will of God Available at Stand to Reason, about how that plays itself out specifically. So if you want a model, that's where it is. But there is a plan. But the plan is in God's sovereign mind, and we can look back over our shoulders and see his hand in the plan. But the plan isn't fulfilled because we've somehow squeezed this information out of God using these little techniques, and then we finally, oh, that's it. Oh, that's how I'm being led. Oh, I got it right. I threaded the needle of God's plan. I figured out what I was being led to do, and then I did the thing that God wanted me to do. The plan is a perfect plan from God himself, but I mean perfect from his perspective, not perfect from ours, in which his purposes are sovereignly decreed in all that human beings do. His sovereign purposes get worked out, and these include and entail even the sinful actions of man. But they are not God's sovereign plan, blueprint that we can see in hindsight is not available to us for us to make our decisions today. What is available to us is God's moral will and wisdom and counsel from the body of Christ and the like that I described in the series. So that's how the blueprint plan works out in this situation.
So, because I was first tempted to think that it would be God's sovereign will, the things looking back and saying, you know, what God did, because it gets it's usually very specific when people discuss that kind of thing. Oh, I see what God did here, and I see what God did here.
Yeah, sure.
Whether it was really God or something that may have just happened, you know, a lot of times it's hard to tell. But
let me jump in for a second here, because
yeah, sure,
we would have to say that everything that took place was part of God's sovereign purposes. Even if it happened, seemed to be serendipitous or didn't seem to have a relationship to anything, God works all things after the counsel of his will. So God's sovereign purposes kind of encompass everything, even though it may not be the case that God caused this particular action. Did God cause the brothers to throw Joseph into the pit? Well, I don't want to say that. That was an evil thing. But it was all encompassed in God's sovereign purpose to save and rescue the fledgling nation of Israel. So it's something on that order.
Okay. Yeah. And I was also thinking that it's something that's kind of built into, I guess, the Christian model of living, that the consequences to, or the results of Christian living and Christian desires in our lives, mm-hmm, is we can see that being played out and point to God.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I guess in the same way as part of his plan.
Yeah. Well, look at Paul in Galatians chapter 1. Paul talks about being called by God from his womb. I'm just going by memory now. I'm looking for it. But God, who set me apart from birth, you know, mm-hmm, God had his hand on Paul from the very beginning. And Paul understood that all of his manner of life with the Jews that he talks about in Philippians chapter 3, all of those things that he learned and he did, excelling beyond his brethren and all of that stuff, still God was the one who had his hand on him, you know? God was the one who, yeah, this is all in chapter 1 of Galatians. In my former manner of life in Judaism, I used to persecute the church, but I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries among my countrymen, being more extremely zealous for my ancestral traditions. But when God, who had set me apart even from my mother's womb, called me through his grace, he was pleased to reveal his son in me that I might preach him among the Gentiles. And on he goes. So all that stuff that Paul learned, it wasn't for naught. It became a foundation now that can be used by God for the purpose that that God was now in Paul's life accomplishing as an apostle, but set apart from his mother's womb. That was an observation Tim Keller made in a sermon I listened to recently. I think it's a fair one. And I think you and I could both look at our lives, even things that happened before we were Christians, God's sovereign hand that brought to fruition certain purposes and plans in our lives, but the whole thing started before we even were Christians, and we can just see it all laid out there as we look back. Doesn't mean we see everything, but we can certainly see the hand of God. Wouldn't you say?
I agree.
Yeah. All righty. Does that help?
Yes. Thank you so much. One last thing. When was the last time you explained the chicken?
I think it's on our website somewhere, but I'll tell you very quickly. I used to have a caller many years ago, 20 years ago at least, who was not a Christian. He was an Eastern religion devotee, and he believed in reincarnation and indeed had a guru that he followed. And on their particular view, they believed in the transmigration of the soul. That means you could be reincarnated from an animal, and that every human being was, and they had in their human personality the characteristics of the animal that they had been in a prior life. And so I asked him to check with his guru and ask him what kind of animal I was in a prior life, and he called back the next week and said that I was a rooster. And this, I mean, it was a hilarious conversation, and so ever since then, this has been a little detail in the show.
It's been a while since I've heard that, and I mean, this is for, you know, anybody that listens to them and hears this mysterious chicken every time.
Yes, right.
Who ate, or a rooster.
And who ate my chicken? I think I actually, that recording of the rooster crowing is me. And I don't know if I was, you know, just sounding off during the break after that or during that particular segment, but it was right around that time and I did the and we were making a big joke, and whoever was on the soundboard that day captured me doing that, and it's been with us ever since.
Oh, okay.
So there you have it. Okay, Zeb?
Thank you so much, Greg.
Yeah, great talking to you. I'm glad you called. Let's take a quick break and back with your remaining calls here on Stand to Reason.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study the Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order the Bible Fast Forward.
All right. right, friends. Final segment here in the show. Let's jump right to Ron in West Hills, California. Hi, Ron.
Great. I get to talk to the rooster.
I guess it's been a while since I explained that. But
Yes. I just want to make a quick comment. You know, a couple weeks ago, you dropped the third hour, and I was shocked because you had no calls waiting. Once in a while, you just need to let us know that the lines are, that you have a line open, because I think a lot of us presume that these lines are filled from the beginning of the show and there's no way you're going to get in. And sometimes, you know, even as we're listening to the show, we have questions, but we don't even realize we perhaps could get in if you just give us a hint.
Well, the way to do that is, Melinda said we had tech problems that day too, and that was a big issue.
Okay.
But just as a practical matter, we have a map over here that show how many people are actually listening at any given time through live streaming, and that's not a really large number. So if I say the lines are open, the only ones that are going to know that are this handful of people that are live streaming. Anybody who's listening by tape delay, it's not going to help.
Yeah, but we still may want to call in.
All right. Well, so if are you a live streamer?
Yes.
All right.
Yes,
well, then I will keep that in mind. And so if I say lines are open or getting low or something like that, then those of you who are live streaming, you know that if you'd like, you can jump in. I will do that for you, Ron.
Okay. Now, here's my question. You know, as someone who's opposed to same-sex marriage, you know, we're always put in a position of name-calling right away. You know, obviously we're homophobes, and the word homophobe actually means that we either have an aversion or fear of homosexuals, or even worse, they begin to call us names like we're hateful. You know,
right, sure.
That's always taken with that name. Is there a neutral position that we're ever given, or some people allowed a kind of a moral higher ground because they kind of sit like they're neutral? They're not evangelical or Christian or saying that homosexuality is sin, and they're not homosexuals, but they seem to be able to sit in a position where they can say, oh, you're a homophobe, you know, because you oppose same-sex marriage. Are they allowed to be able to have that neutral position, or are we?
Well, I think I suspect. Let me back up and put it this way. In the public discussion, if you are, regardless of your own religious conviction affiliation, if you are against same-sex marriage, then you are going to be called a homophobe and a hater, period. Because that is the tactic that they use, and it works. It's not a sound tactic. That doesn't mean that everybody who is in favor of same-sex marriage thinks that those who are not in favor of it are homophobes or guilty of hate towards homosexuals. I think there are a lot of people who would not make that unfair charge, that they understand there can be many people who have principled concerns about same-sex marriage, and in fact wouldn't have anything to do with the morality of homosexuality. None of my arguments against same-sex marriage has anything to do with the morality of homosexuality. Homosexuality might be completely moral. That doesn't mean that that therefore same-sex marriage is a good thing on a policy level. So there are fair-minded people, I think, that will see that. But these are not the ones that are really involved in the public discussion. And so when you have this this bill passed in New Mexico or Arizona, which was subsequently vetoed by the governor, you have newspapers like the New York Times that called it the anti-gay bill. Because it wasn't, this is not accurate. It just was not accurate, but it served their rhetorical purpose. And you cannot count on even a noble newspaper, a large newspaper like that, to be fair-minded and even-handed in the way they treat these things. They have an agenda. And so now, does that mean that, you know, Fox News doesn't have an agenda? It does have an agenda, but it's very different. It's one thing to have an agenda. It's another thing to have the agenda cause you to distort the communication of the news. And when the New York Times called this the gay, anti-gay bill. That was a distortion that reflected their agenda. Maybe they should have said it's just as the whatever called it something else that was more neutral, and then weighed in on the editorial page and said they were against this bill for whatever reasons. But they don't have to distort the news to make their point. But it is very convenient, and it's especially on this particular issue, you can make so much headway so easily by just essentially calling names and mischaracterizing things in that way.
Okay. Now, would it be fair, or would this just be another name-calling, if someone is trying to take this neutral position, and just like in some issues, you can't be neutral, you know, about abortion, for instance, with the homosexuality, would it be fair to say, well, if you're not, if I'm considered a homophobe because I'm opposed, would it be fair to say, well, then you're a homophile, not meaning they're a homosexual, but that they favor homosexual views, or they're favorable to it, or would that be kind of like name calling in a
well?
In a
it might be. I don't think that kind of label is necessary. But now I'm a little confused. When you say neutral, do you mean neutral? That is, you can have a point of view against homosexuality or same-sex marriage, but you are not a homophobe technically.
Yes.
Yes. That's what you mean by that's not neutral. That just means you don't have a vice associated with your opinion against homosexuality or same-sex marriage. That's all. So it wouldn't be neutral. You're not neutral, but it might be you would like for people to treat you as morally neutral. That would be the charitable way of going about it, instead of assuming that you have these nefarious motives that are behind your point of view. No, you're not against it for that reason, that noble reason that you think it's bad policy. You're against it because you hate homosexuals, because you're a bigot. It would be nice if people were more consistently charitable. But you're not going to see this characteristically, at least the ones that are involved. You're not going to see it with those who are involved in the discussion. So
we just have to kind of accept it and try to brush it off and try to still continue.
Here's my suggestion. You be careful not to fulfill the stereotype.
Okay.
And secondly, then you hold people accountable for their name calling. Mm-hmm. When Jesus was at his trial, someone slapped him. And he said to the person who slapped him, "If I have done wrong, bear witness to the wrong. If I have done no wrong, then why did you slap me?" Now, this is instructive because Jesus held the people who were acting inappropriately accountable. He called them to accountability for their behavior, even at his own trial. I think we can say this to people, you know, when they say, "Well, you're a homophobe." We could ask, "Why did you change the subject? Why, instead of addressing the issue, did you choose to simply call names?"
Okay.
Ridicule is not an argument.
Okay, Greg, thank you very much.
All right, Ron. Yeah, I appreciate your call. Let's talk with Tom in Greeley, Colorado. You made it, Tom.
Hello?
Hello, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. You got in under the wire here.
Well, good. I have read your Solid Ground article, it was within the last year or so, on theistic evolution,
drifting,
problems associated with that.
Yeah, drifting towards Darwin is the title.
Right.
Right.
Just a little background. My daughter and son-in-law, my son-in-law recently graduated from a small college in the South, where there's a big debate going on right now about, and the school tradition has been towards a young earth creationist view.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a big debate going on right now because they want to not change the school's statement of belief, but clarify it to favor more of the young earth creationist view.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with some of the professors holding a theistic evolutionary view, this has people upset, of course. Mm-hmm. And
would this mean that their statement of faith would be something that the professors are going to have to sign on to?
That's the belief, although the administration in a lot of their writings has claimed that that won't be the case.
Well,
but
it does create an awkwardness, though. You propose or you represent yourself to the public who are considering going to your school with a certain set of beliefs, but then you do not require the professors to sign off on those beliefs. Then what guarantee do you have, what assurance do you have that the children that you send to that school are going to get the teaching consistent with the statement of faith?
Right, and I agree with that. I think
that's a practical matter, but
yeah, that's the practical concern. Because I mean, I share your view on that you talked about in the article, drifting towards Darwinism. So I'm not a young Earth. I don't consider myself a young Earth creationist, but I'm also not a by any stretch of the imagination, theistic evolution.
Right. And so there's a third category, right?
Right. I understand. Or after reading over most of the concerns of people, I kind of find myself in the camp of, well, you know, the school is they should have been, if they really were wanting to take the position of a young Earth creationist view, and that was their tradition, they should have been upholding that from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
instead of now trying to backtrack and say, well, we really hold this view, and those who don't, you know.
Yeah, well, look, it seems to me if the school has a statement of faith, that has to mean something.
Right.
If they list these things and they say, this is what we believe, who is the we? It has to be those who represent the school, not just the Board of Regents or the president. It has to be the Board of Regents and president don't do the teaching.
Right.
You send your kids to a school because of, in a situation like that, because you have come to count on a certain theological perspective that is represented by the school in its teaching. So if it has a statement of faith that the professors don't sign off on, then I don't think as a practical matter what the point the statement of faith actually fulfills.
Right.
So now this may be really awkward now because they are playing catch up, but I know it was Al Mohler when he went to whatever Baptist school he went to, he had a clean house a little bit, and it was to bring his faculty up to speed with their statement of faith.
Right.
So now, if they don't want to put this in their statement of faith and they want to have, you know, they want to make their perspective broad enough to include theistic evolution professors because they think it's good that their students are exposed to that, well, then I think they should alter, that they should make this public and clear. Then those professors can stay, but then, you know, maybe some people won't send their kids to that school. If they've got to have integrity in which the statement of faith matches what is being taught in the classroom. That would be
on that
practical matter. Now, do I think that theistic evolution is sound? I don't think it's sound on two grounds. I don't think Darwinism in its standard neo-Darwinian synthesis sense is sound. I think it falters on the merits itself, regardless of my religious view. But I also think when you take religious considerations into consideration, you're going to have a very difficult time making sense of an historical Adam and therefore an historical fall with theistic evolution. And last fall at ETS, I asked Dennis Lamoureux, who was making an appeal for theistic evolution, I asked him, was there any and therefore no historical Adam. I asked him, was there any time for humankind of original innocence? And he said that question doesn't matter as far as he's concerned. Now, he's Orthodox in everything else, you know, all the other things. He just does not believe in Adam and Eve, and he thinks original innocence does not matter. I think that it matters a lot.
Right.
So if a person just believes in theistic evolution and that's their view, God somehow worked with it, I don't think that's accurate, but I'm not going to fuss about it. However, if they then say, and there was no Adam, now I think you've got real theological problems.
Right.
What
and I,
I just want to distinguish between this scores and scores, gobs of well-meaning Christians who think that God used evolution but haven't thought through it to the point of what's the story of Adam, and the ones who think that evolution is true and are willing to dismiss Adam in the process. Those are two different groups of people to me.
Right. And I think that's a good point because, like you said, I think there's lots of people out there, well-meaning Christians, who are faithful in every other Orthodox belief, but right. they just haven't thought the matter through.
Yeah, they just think evolution is true and God used it, and that's as far as they've taken it. Now, right. Dennis Lamoureux, when he says, yeah, and here's where it goes, no Adam, now I think you got a real problem. I'm not saying Dennis Lamoureux is not a Christian, but I think that is severely heterodox.
That was kind of where I was going with the question is, at what point does it be, is theistic evolution heterodox heresy, or what point does it become one of those?
I think it's radically heterodox to say that Adam didn't exist, because Paul and Jesus both believed he did. And when we asked this question, Dennis Lamoureux said that Paul was a man of his time. He was as ignorant of origins as everybody else. So that's just a fancy way of saying that Paul got it wrong, because he didn't have the benefit of modern science. Paul didn't realize there was no one Adam. There was a large population of original human beings. I don't even know what that means, because my question then is, where did they come from, for goodness sake,
Right.
But when you say that Paul was wrong, now you're starting to undermine the authority of Scripture. What else was Paul just the victim of his culture on?
Right.
Substitutionary atonement? And if not, why not? What makes that authoritative but his understanding of Adam and the fall inaccurate? You see the slippery slope here.
Right.
Yeah.
It certainly makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And it's not a casual slippery slope. I'm not just saying one thing leads to another. I'm saying on your thinking, when the person says Paul was a man of his time, then you have to ask, well, what other things were actually influenced by his misunderstanding? Not just Adam, but other things as well. He was wrong about the first Adam. Is he wrong about the second Adam? Why or why not? How do we avoid that logical slippery slope where the same principle applies to the second thing as equally as it applies to the first? How do we avoid that? That's the concern. And this is where I think we start slipping really aggressively towards not just heterodoxy, where things are just false but still within the pale, but also heresy, where we've lost the orthodox point of view. Tom, I thank you for your call. It's a good way to end the evening. And I thank you for listening, friends. Time to go, and I'll be back with you next time around, okay? It was a good show, and I enjoyed your interaction. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Go out and give them heaven this week, okay? Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.